want to look at updating your performance benchmark also. Moving on, now we're getting into the much smaller exposure. PIMCO had less than one basis point of exposure. So on a plan level, it is, you know, even smaller. Good news, it's in a separate account. Work with the manager to update the guidelines. Moving on. Here we have again two managers where the exposure is very small on a fund level, and then on a plan level, even smaller. So you're talking 1 to 2 basis points of exposure. Here we might suggest you would assess the materiality of the exposure for both American Century and Capital Group, the American Bond Fund. Moving on. So what are next steps? Should you agree to these suggestions? You would direct staff to implement the approved changes, update your separate accounts where applicable, review fund documents also where applicable. In the instance, there are other vehicles that are suitable. You may want to address the benchmark to include an ex-China in your performance measurement. I think one of the main takeaways is that you will want to establish ongoing monitoring to see, you know, this is just a snapshot in time. As of right now, there is not a lot of exposure to China in the plan, but on an ongoing basis, you may want to implement monitoring. And then finally, once agreed on all of these changes, you may want to update your IPS to incorporate these restrictions. In the appendix, we lay out some of the performance of the vehicle that Acadian offers. It runs the same strategy as your existing, but just excludes China. And then in the remaining appendix, we lay out the statute as it stands. So with that, that concludes our presentation on SB 1221. Any questions?
Thank you, Eugene. Go ahead, Sylvia.
Yeah, thanks for the presentation. I don't have specifically questions on that, but I just have a question for Cassie. What are the ramifications if we don't do this? By state, is that described in the statute?
No, it's not. So it is, when I've dug into the statute to try to find any history and discussion, it was a very high-level discussion in the legislature focused on state-level monies, and there was nothing specifically addressed in terms of penalties for non-compliance. However, this provision, this China divestment statute, has been added to the Arizona statutes under a series of other provisions you're probably familiar with, Sylvia, about, you know, state sponsors of terrorism. So that is the context that this was adopted. And in 2025, when this legislation was presented and enacted, there were a number of China-related measures in front of the legislature, everything from this investment provision to organ harvesting. And so when I look at those all together, I do think that it was a general impetus to focus on China as a potential terrorism actor. And it was to get the, I don't want to speak for the legislature, but it appears that it was to get these sentiments coded into law, and there's zero implementation or scheme for compliance enforcement. In this instance, because we can make some fairly straightforward changes to bring the fund exposure below that 1% threshold, I see no reason not to move forward with those. If Callan was saying, no, that's going to be adverse to the portfolio, or if we were sitting at 10% today, obviously we'd have a much harder discussion in front of us. But since we're at that 1.8% threshold now, and there are viable alternatives within those existing managers, my recommendation is to follow the Callan recommendations and bring that exposure into alignment with the statute as soon as we can.
Yeah, and I did want to say I do support the motion to liquidate some of those funds as necessary, but just was curious to see if it was specific on what happens if we don't.
Yeah, and to that point, Sylvia, the other provisions already in Arizona law also don't have enforcement provisions. The Sudan and the other restrictions are written very similarly.
These laws have a tendency to beg the question, why were they passed if they don't have any provisions for enforcement? I think there were, how do I put the words, performative. Having said that, I certainly don't think anybody on our board wants to be in a position where we are ignoring Arizona law. That's just not a good place to be. I believe there's only one other member of our board who is a member of the state bar. And I don't know, John, are you still a member of the state bar or have you retired?
I'm on hold until I have to go back to work in the future sometime.
Okay. All right. I know for myself that it is conceivable that actively participating in a process that involves violating Arizona law is perhaps a violation of the rules of professional conduct. So I'm certainly hopeful that our board is not, and I'm not suggesting, Sylvia, that you were headed there. I think it was more in the nature of a question. Having digressed, I apologize. I did ask Cassie to draft a motion so that we would have something on the table. That motion is in your materials. Is there anybody who is willing to move the motion that is in the materials?
I will. You want me to read out the motion?
Is the motion okay? Are you suggesting that you support the entire four bullet points?
Yes.
Okay. I think everybody can see that. I don't know that we need to read it out loud. Is there a second for that motion?
Second.
Thank you.
Just quick item of discussion. Are any of these motions in conflict with each other, or are these a congruent package?
They're intended to be a consistent package, yes. So I think it'd be appropriate to cover all four.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. Let me just observe in the pre-meeting conference that Kim, Cassie, Eugene, and I had. I guess it was a couple of weeks ago. I lose track of time. We did discuss the fact that the statute is not clear about what comprises the People's Republic of China and other places controlled by the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese military. We did, for the moment at least, take the position that we think, as we're evaluating, that it's hard to argue that Hong Kong is not within the statutory definition. It's hard to argue that Taiwan, at least as of today, is within the statutory definition. I think I said is not for Hong Kong. And I think we decided, if I recall correctly, that Macau was also, for at least for the moment, part of the definition as opposed to being excluded. So Hong Kong, Macau are within the definition, and Taiwan is outside the definition. And that's the operating premise for the moment, at least. Are there questions or discussion?
Reading the text of the statute, is there any risk if we do as soon as possible that we may would it be better to do as soon as prudent to meet the deadline? Because if we're directing them to go as soon as possible, we may be taking on more risk than we need to comply by September.
Where the main reducing the bulk of the exposure, as I mentioned, is through two managers, Causeway and Acadian. In the event of the liquidating the mutual fund, that should be a relatively straightforward process. That mutual fund sits within the Causeway separate account. For the Acadian transition, it would be a case of, you know, pending document review. I think where there is remaining exposure, that's where you assess the materiality of that remaining exposure. I certainly think, you know, it's prudent to ask the manager to comply as best possible, you know, taking into account any negative impact of selling immediately, etc.
Like as best possible with the intent to comply by said date, right? Or something to that effect.
Yes.
Is that a friendly amendment? Is that your intent, Tarleton?
Yes. Yeah, I motion we amend that.
Okay. Do the maker and the seconder accept that amendment?
I accept the friendly amendment.
Okay. And I don't recall who seconded.
Second, this is Terry.
Okay, and you're good with that as well?
Yes.
All right. I don't have a sense with any of this that market timing is a critical issue, but the point is taken and accepted. All right. Any other questions or discussion?
Yes, I noticed, this is Angel. The first bullet point, redirecting Causeway to liquidate and then present options to reinvest. Would it not be best for Causeway to find possible options and then present to us and liquidate based on the options? I'm just trying to understand the direction here.
Okay, that was part of our discussion a couple of weeks ago. And the feeling was we did not want to create a situation where we were bumping up against the deadline, waiting for possible options and further micromanaging the issue. That's why the motion is drafted the way it's drafted. Compliance is the priority, and the investments will be found. And bear in mind here that if we assume our valuation presently is $1 billion, we're talking in the aggregate totally for all of these investments, roughly $15 to $18 million. So selecting an issue and deciding to put it on hold is likely going to create more burden for staff, for Callan, et cetera, than the likely value of being set at any given moment. That was the reasoning. Did I say that fairly, Eugene?
Yes. So we did discuss options to keep the structure as, for instance, with Causeway, to keep the exposure as close to what it is. That would involve moving from the mutual fund to a separate account. There are time considerations, and the implementation of that would take multiple months. And therefore, in the interest of the deadlines, we can, I think, reassess. There may be an opportunity at a later date to do a structure study and reassess that exposure. But in the interim, this is a relatively straightforward opportunity to bring down that exposure.
All right. Any other questions or discussion? All right. Dawn, would you call the vote, please?
Angel Isamillum?
Aye.
Terry Train?
Aye.
Dave Samer?
Aye.
Tarleton Farren?
Aye.
Sylvia Ambrano?
Aye.
John O'Hare?
Aye.
Mark Rubin?
Aye.
The motion passes 7-0.
Thank you all. The next item is a Callan item, the Fidelity Land Bridge purchase.
Yes, so Fidelity maintains a separate account. You maintain a separate account on which Fidelity invests. They have had a number of compliance flags hit by the team wanting to invest in securities that are not strictly defined as laid out in your IPS. In particular, these relate to LLCs and MLPs. In order to reduce administrative burden going forward, they have suggested potentially removing these flags. My concern there is that a blanket removal of these flags or approval to allow LLCs and MLP investments, there are instances where there may be tax administration that is required, and the administrative burden of that needs to be considered. In particular, UBTI, etc. So what we would recommend is that you do not create a blanket approval for these type of investments, but instead continue on a case-by-case basis where the investment manager can confirm there will be no adverse or extra tax filings or paperwork required related to the investments.
Mr. Chair, may I add to that?
Sure.
I don't recall any of these kind of transactions coming before the board previously. And when Eugene is referencing UBTI, I don't think we've talked about that either. That's unrelated business tax that can arise within a retirement plan investment. And it is something we want to avoid. Obviously, our goal is to have zero tax implications from anything that the system does. So it seems to me, and Eugene, correct me if I'm wrong, that the flags that Fidelity Compliance is raising are correct and appropriate. So from my perspective, I don't think that we want to get into any investment transactions that would potentially complicate our administration or trigger tax. And I think that the IPS is working as it should in this case.
In this case, you could ask them to confirm whether the investment would or would not trigger. There are instances where it may not, but again, this is on a case-by-case basis, and creating a blanket inclusion for these type of investments is probably too blunt an approach.
Okay. So is this an action item or not?
I think, Eugene, are they requiring an instruction back from the board, or are they just telling us that transactions are prevented right now?
They would like, for these two transactions, they would like an instruction from the board.
For these two transactions, then my recommendation would be either that the board says we are not interested under the current IPS, or we get specific confirmation that it will not create tax implications for the system. I don't know how significant these transactions are, Eugene, for the system.
Well, it will be, you know, one or two trades within a small portion of your existing manager. So it's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction, not particularly meaningful.
Can we reiterate our intent not to have that tax liability and burden and put it on them to return if they believe it's of sufficient value for our consideration otherwise? I think it's good their compliance caught it.
Right.
So I guess it begs the question, if they're going to tell us, or we're going to tell them not to put us at risk, and somebody says, yeah, you're not at risk, but it turns out we end up with the tax, what do we do then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not because somebody wasn't paying attention or they did something wrong. Things don't, you know, the law can change. Things just don't always work out the way you think they will.
Yeah.
And the reality is that if these are fractions of fractions of fractions, the potential tax is a fraction of that. And I'm not saying that that's okay, but it's also likely not something that is terribly significant. And I get, as the chair, I'm trying to figure out what do we put forward in the way of a motion to deal with the issue. And do we need to deal with this at this meeting? Are they in a position where they need an instruction now?
I believe they would like an instruction. However, I think it, given you say it's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction, it, you know, won't be on a plan level. It's difficult to argue that it will be meaningful. However, the impact from an operational point of view and paperwork may be more burdensome than that residual, I guess, exposure is worth.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, my suggestion would be for the board to consider a motion that the LLC and MLP investments are not authorized under the IPS, which would mean that these flag transactions will not proceed.
That's certainly that's the cleanest way to deal with the issue, I think.
Dave has his hand up.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh, I wanted to just add to this. I actually work in public accounting and have had to prepare UBTI tax returns for profit sharing plans and IRAs. And one of the issues with them is frequently the cost of preparing the return can exceed the actual tax involved. Mm-hmm. So it is a real administrative nightmare. And one of the other issues with LLCs and LPs is that the tax is based on the ongoing underlying assets of the LLC, which could change, that at the time that the plan would buy it, it could be exempt from UBTI, but they could enter into transactions at the LLC level that would make it subject to tax. So I'd agree that having the continuing our blanket exclusion against these investments would probably make the most sense given the small portion they are to our plan and the potential compliance risk and costs of compliance.
Thanks, Dave, for the perspective. That's appreciated and helpful. All right. So I think I heard a recommendation that we have a motion that says we're not doing this. Forgive the plain talk. Can that get put into more appropriate words afterwards?
Yes.
Okay. Will somebody make that motion?
Yeah, I can make that motion that we avoid direct LLC MLP investments in accordance with our policy in this case.
Okay.
Or that we exclude it.
Yeah. All right. Is there a second?
Second.
All right. Thank you. Any discussion? Hearing none. Don, would you call the vote, please?
Angel Ozamellum.
Aye.
Terry Train.
Aye.
Dave Samer.
Aye.
Tarleton Farron.
Aye.
Sylvia Amperano.
Aye.
John O'Hare.
Aye.
Mark Rubin.
Aye.
Motion passes 7-0.
Okay, great. All right. We have presentations from mid-cap managers. And it looks like Eugene, how much time were you, what did you tell folks in terms of time? if anything.
About now is great. I think I suggested the initial discussions would take 30 minutes. So I think we're there or thereabout. I advised most of the managers that we were dealing with a evolving situation regarding the SB 1221. And it looks like the T. Rowe Price people are here already to discuss the small mid-cap core equity strategy. So with that, I guess probably hand over.
I wasn't clear. I was asking how much time did you suggest each presenter group would have?
We discussed that 40 minutes per manager would be enough time to get through the discussion.
Okay, so that's, and we've got four, so that's 1 hour and 20, that's 2 hours and 40 minutes. Let's have at it. We'll take a break at some point in that process, but I've got 9:05. So T. Rowe Price, you all, would you please focus on being done by about 9:45? Okay.
Absolutely.
Take it away.
That, no problem. Yep.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
So, and just a little brevity is the soul of life. Go on.
Completely understand. For logistics, would you like us to put our presentation up, or do you have that in front of you?
Do you want to share their presentation? Gwen, it should be in the packet. It's page 34, starting.
We can do that as well.
Oh, okay. John, yeah, it may be better if you do it. Also, John, your audio is a little bit quiet, just for your guide.
Okay. See if I can talk a little closer here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to be brief. My name is John Mazdey. I'm on the service team. We have with us David Corris, our portfolio manager, and Brian Dausch, our portfolio specialist, to talk about our integrated equity mid-cap core U.S. Strategy. I'll just say two things. One, T. Rowe Price is known for deep fundamental research for 90 years, but in the 1990s, we started this quantitative equity capabilities. And this is the deliberate presentation of these two alpha insights coming together to provide a distinct portfolio that provides kind of stock-specific alpha over time. David, Brian, why don't I turn it over to you right away to jump into this so we can get moving.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you all for having us. This is Brian Dausch, the portfolio specialist, and I'll pass it over to David in a moment. Given that you know T. Rowe on the fundamental side, you know, through your investment with one of our other strategies, I thought it might be useful even just to build it out a little bit more in terms of the background that John gave around our integrated approach of blending quant fundamental together. You will notice on page 7 of our deck a little bit of a timeline that kind of speaks to what John was saying, that we've also been doing quantitative investing a long time at T. Rowe back to the 1990s. We started managing money using this approach of combining quant and fundamental together about 20 years ago, back in 2006. And overall, our team is actually managing 13 different strategies today and $26 billion in aggregate in AUM. The SMID-core strategy that we'll discuss today, thank you, that's the timeline page. The SMID-core strategy that we'll discuss today started in 2016, so we have a 10-year track record with that. We're a little over $3 billion in terms of assets. And I'd say what has kind of attracted clients to us, similarly in long-dated plans such as yourselves, having a strategy that has a really consistent and robust process, that leads to a style pure portfolio that is able to drive consistent performance in alpha over time without really big swings in either returns or risk in terms of the portfolio. So more, I'd say, risk aware, risk controlled, approach to investing in small and mid cap, which has been a pretty volatile asset class, for some time. If I maybe skip us ahead one page, just very briefly, as far as the team, and then I'll pass along to David. This is the integrated equity team. So David, Corris, and Prashant Jagannath, who are on the second row, they're the co-portfolio managers of this strategy. But you'll notice that we have, quite a number of individuals on the team. senior investors that are managing the various portfolios that the team is running. Also research analysts, the bottom three rows are all research analysts that are kind of dealing with the quantitative research that we do at T. Rowe Price. And then finally, if we go to the next page on page nine, when I say that we blend quant and fundamental, the fundamental alpha source that we're using is the T. Rowe Price fundamental research platform. So 160 plus equity professionals that are ultimately experts within their respective industries and is serving up ideas to portfolios across the board. So we've got the largest, or if not the largest, certainly one of the largest small mid-cap platforms in the world, both in terms of analysts, but then also our ownership of small mid-cap stocks. So why don't I pause there for a moment before I see if there's questions before I pass along to David to go through a little bit more detail around our philosophy and process and portfolio.
So should I ask a question?
John has a question.
Yeah.
Actually, I was raising my hand for John.
Okay. Looking at the pictures of the team, the 15 members,
yes.
There seems to be 13 men, but only two women in it. Is the fund looking at recruiting more women?
Sure, I can start off on that. Others may want to opine. I'm sorry, was there an additional part of that question before I start off?
Was that the whole question?
No.
You're right. There's 15 pictures up there, but there's only two women on the team. And my wife tells me women are more detailed oriented. So there should be more people on their team.
Sure.
That's the question.
Yeah. Yes, sir. We have pretty extensive recruiting processes, kind of hitting across all the major business schools and lateral hires and things like that. And we certainly take diversity very seriously at T. Rowe, and probably have a number of stats that we can share. Ultimately, we're trying to find, what we think are the best talent of individuals that are well designed to understand fundamental investing and quantitative investing and bringing those together. So you notice Bailey and Yihan on the page are women on the team. And I'd say we continue to look for opportunities as we bring new members to the team to ensure that we're getting the best talent that we can kind of across a diverse backgrounds. So John, David, if there's anything else you want to opine, feel free.
Okay, thank you.
Great. David, over to you.
Great. Thanks, Brian. And thank you all for your time today. Really appreciate the opportunity to meet you and be able to talk about our mid-cap core strategy. Just by way of introduction, I'm David Corris. I'm the lead portfolio manager for the SMID strategy. And I've been managing SMID assets as a PM for 20 years using this quant fundamental approach that we're going to talk about today. Before I get into the details, I just wanted to highlight the three key messages that I hope that you take away after I go into all the details. The first is that we have two different sources of alpha that we combine together. Both of those alpha sources have been proven to be powerful over time, but they also tend to work at different times. So they're complementary and they're also powerful in their intersection. So it's really, how do we take two sources of alpha, put them together, and use that to deliver a consistent alpha experience for our clients over time? Second is risk management. We've spent a lot of time thinking about risk management pretty deeply, especially given changes to the mid-cap market structure since COVID, with all the retail traders and thematic ETFs, et cetera. And I think we're doing a lot of really good work on the risk management side. The third is just delivering client solutions that match what they're looking for. We've designed our SMID-cap core strategy to be a low turnover strategy that stays very squarely in the core style box, so that as what we've found in talking to a lot of our institutional clients is they really value the style of purity, knowing that we're always going to deliver what we said we're going to deliver and do it using an institutional caliber, repeatable and consistent investment process. And putting all those three together is really the package that we'd like to offer to you today. For starters, I'd like to just quickly talk about our philosophy. I would say that if you look across the economy, virtually every industry, there's evidence coming out that when you combine human decision makers with data and analytics, you end up with better outcomes than only the human decision maker alone or only the data and analytics running alone. And you see that whether it's medicine with things like radiology or you see it with sports and gaming. But there's a lot of examples that when you combine the domain expert and the data and analytics, you do get better outcomes. The one industry that really hasn't adopted this very much is investments. And there's a lot of managers that talk about how they try to incorporate quantum fundamental. But having done it for 20 years, I've realized there are very few people in the industry that can actually do it in a meaningful 50-50 way. And the reason for that is that you need to have three things in place in order to do it well. The first is you need to have a world-class fundamental platform, and that's one of the strengths of T. Rowe. The second is you need a world-class quant platform, and as Brian mentioned, we've been running money with this approach for over 20 years with very strong results. The third thing you need, which is the most overlooked, is culture, because typically quantitative investors and fundamental investors view the world very differently. And there's a lot of examples of firms trying to put quant and fundamental together and having it fail because the cultures don't really align with each other. And in the interest of time, I'll leave it at that, but I'm happy to go during Q&A into a little bit more depth as to why the cultural disagreements are so hard to bridge. But one of the things that I think makes T. Rowe really special and competitively advantaged in this space is that we have an investment-led culture with a long history of the quant and fundamental parts of the business working well together. And that's just something that in most firms, it's really hard to get right because quants and fundamentals just fundamentally view the world differently. And so I think the most special thing that we've been able to do here is take our fundamental platforms alpha, our quantitative platforms alpha, and then leverage the culture that T. Rowe has to build a disciplined, rules-based, institutional quality integration of both of those alpha sources. And that's what I'll talk about later today. The one other thing I want to address quickly before I get into there is that this quant fundamental approach has been really successful for our team over time and across a lot of different asset classes. But having done this for 20 years, I feel very, very strongly that it's best suited for SMID cap. And in SMID cap, I really think that this is the best way to manage money. The reason I say that is that there are characteristics of the SMID cap universe that are kind of unique, some of which quant is ideally suited to solve, some of which fundamental is ideally suited to address. And the two of them together provide a package that neither one in isolation can. So just to give you a little bit of background on how I view the asset class, in terms of where quant comes in handy, there's two key criteria. The first is that you have a 2,500 stock universe, and there is no firm in the world that has comprehensive deep coverage of the whole SMID cap universe. T. Rowe, as Brian mentioned, is the largest SMID cap manager in the industry. We have pretty good coverage, but even at T. Rowe, we're not exhaustive. And quantitative models give you an ability to analyze the entire universe every day with consistent criteria. So the quantitative part of our process allows us to scour the whole universe and find a lot of undiscovered gems. The second thing is that risk management and portfolio construction is really important in SMID cap, partially because of liquidity. Liquidity and transaction costs are an explicit cost to our clients, and quantitative techniques are really good at helping think about trade sizes and balancing alpha generation with cost management. Also, risk is a lot more significant in small cap. Both individual companies are more volatile, so you have to think about position sizing based on risk. And also, you have a lot of thematic exposures that have been bubbling up, whether it's quantum computing or cryptocurrency or different variations of AI. And quantitative approaches are really well suited for measuring and managing risks pretty comprehensively. So in my view, for SMID cap investing, a quantitative component is really, really powerful due to the breadth of the universe and all the risk management and liquidity management involved. On the other side, though, quant alone is not sufficient in SMID-cap. The first reason for that is that there's a lot of stock-specific risk that you need to know about. A lot of these SMID-cap companies have product concentration or customer concentration, things that quant models aren't going to really be aware of. Second of all, you have areas like biotech and early stage software that quant models are not really well suited for adapting to, and where fundamental analysts do a much better job. Third is that in the SMID-cap universe, you have a lot of higher growth companies with secular changes going on. And sometimes the historical data is not as predictive as what the future may hold. And that's an area where having fundamental analysts that are looking at these names is really, really important. So in my view, a pure quant approach in SMID is limited. A pure fundamental approach is also limited. And when you combine the two of them together, you can really get the best of both worlds. And it's really ideally suited for the nuances of the SMID-cap universe. So just philosophically, I'm going to spend the rest of the presentation talking about how we actually combine quant and fundamental. But what I want you to take away is that we have this really 50-50 blend of these two disciplines. And in my view, they're both really critical to managing SMID assets well. Let me just pause and see if there are any questions before I go into the details.
Just wanted to say that was well articulated. Thank you for covering that.
Great, thank you. Appreciate it. Sylvia, I see your hand up.
Thanks. So what happens when the two models don't agree? And do you have an example of how that's handled internally when the fundamental and the quantum Yep.
If you're okay with it, I will defer that for two slides. But the very quick answer is that we typically look for stocks where they do agree. We do have cases where we can rely on one versus the other, but we have a systematic process that effectively lets either one act as a veto. So if we have a good quant model score and the analyst doesn't like the stock, we typically don't own it. Conversely, if an analyst likes a stock and our quant model looks really unattractive, we also are not going to own it. So either one effectively has veto power with some small exceptions that I'll describe in a minute.
Great. Okay. I'll hold my questions to the end. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So if we go to page 13, I promise that I'm not going to do like a whole lot of like math and charts and stuff, but I think this one's really important because this is kind of the seminal research underlying our platform. So what I'm going to talk about on this page is the evidence that at T. Rowe Price, our quant models have added value, our fundamental analysts have added value, and the combination of the two has been better than either one in isolation. So this is research that we've done going back to 2005. The x-axis is the quantitative model scores that we've been using, where the best stocks are on the far right and the worst stocks are on the far left. So from a purely quantitative perspective, we want to invest on the right side of the page. The y-axis is the annualized excess return over the last 20 years. And if you look at the three lines and just mentally collapse them into one thick line, you'll see that that thick line slopes from the bottom left to the upper right. What that tells you is that our quant models have added alpha over the last 20 years, because as our quant models have gone from less attractive on the left to more attractive on the right, there's been a pretty linear increase in the realized returns that we've been able to deliver. So the upward slope is the proof statement of our first source of alpha, which is our quantitative models work. Now let's look at the three lines. The blue line is labeled buys, the purple line are labeled sells, and the green line is labeled unrated. These refer to the views of our fundamental analyst platform. So nothing to do with quant anymore. Now we're looking at our analyst ratings, which we've stored in timestamp databases back to 2005. And what you'll see is that the blue line labeled buys is above the green and purple line everywhere on the chart. What that means is that our fundamental analysts, when they put buy ratings on stocks, those stocks have, over the last 20 years at least, outperform the stocks that they have sell ratings on and outperform the stocks that they've chosen not to cover. And importantly, that alpha is independent of whatever the quant score is, because it's a parallel shift upward. So no matter where you are on the x-axis, the blue line is meaningfully higher than the green and the purple lines. So where we are is, at least over the last 20 years, the data suggests that we have two sources of alpha: the quant models demonstrated by that upward slope to the top right, and the fundamental platform demonstrated by that blue line being above the green and the purple. The question is, can you do better than either one? And what we've done is we've highlighted in a blue rectangle the best places in the market to invest over the last 20 years. And what I'd highlight is that the top right of the blue line is really central in that blue rectangle. The top right of the blue line is what happens when quant and fundamental agree. The reason I say that is our fundamental analysts are going to do their bottom-up research. They're going to meet with company management, do their DCF models, and when they find a stock they like, they put it on the blue line. The quant models are going to be crunching all of our data and doing our analysis, and when we find a stock on the quant models that we like, they end up on the right side of the page. So that top right of the blue line is really where the two disciplines coming from different directions come to the same conclusion, which is that a stock is really attractive. And what the data has shown is over the last 20 years, those stocks have outperformed the market by about 2-4% annually. So where I'm going to go in a second is how we actually take this research and put it into practice for this strategy. And as part of that, I'll answer Sylvia's question. But the research and the concept that I want to make sure we leave this page with is that we have these two sources of alpha. And when both of them come to the same conclusion, we tend to get really good outcomes. The consequence is that we're going to really build our portfolio around the top right of that blue line. Before I move on, let me just pause and see if there are any questions about this page. Okay, in that case, John, if we could go to page 23. This is the only other page I'm going to cover in terms of our actual process. But this is how we've taken that research and devise a systematic rules-based approach to put quant and fundamental together with a 50-50 blend. So if you look at the left side of the page, we have the column labeled quant model ranking, where one is best and 10 is worst down the left side. Across the top, we have the analyst rating, sell, unrated, and buy. So this is a 10x3 grid, which is exactly the same thing we just looked at in the research, except instead of 5x3, we've now gone to 10x3 for more granularity. But effectively, what we're looking at is, if you know, like a 2x2 grid where you know the analyst rating on top and you know the quantitative model score on the left. Using those two dimensions, we can highlight what we're going to buy, what we're going to hold, and what we're going to sell. So the green squares are where we're buying new positions. The yellow cells are where we're holding positions, and red is where we're selling. So just to talk through what this means in practice, if you start in that right column labeled buy, if we have an analyst with a positive buy rating on a stock, and that stock is in the top half of our quantitative models, we'll buy the stock. If you go to the middle column where we don't have an analyst rating on a stock, then we have a much higher bar, and it has to be in the top 10% of our quant model. If you go to the left column where our analyst has a negative view, then no matter what the quant model says, we're not going to initiate new positions. So all of the buying is happening in that green zone in the top right. We then use the yellow area just to keep turnover low and to act as kind of a buffer zone. And then as we get into the red, that's when we're going to be eliminating positions. So I think, Sylvia, back to your question, if the quant model gets unattractive, you go to the bottom of the page and it turns red, and that triggers a sell. If the analyst, on the other hand, gets negative and puts a sell rating on and you go to the left side of the page, it also turns red. So either the quant model or the analyst can trigger a sell of the position if it gets sufficiently negative. And we really just, we recycle those basis points back into the top right of the chart where we have stocks that our analysts and our models both really like. The other thing that's not shown on here because it'd be too confusing, but in terms of the rules-based approach, is that every cell in this grid has a target active weight. So if you start in the top right of the grid where the analyst has a buy rating and the model scores top 10%, our largest active weights are going to be 75 basis points over the benchmark. And then as you go down into the left, those numbers get lower until they get to zero. But it gives you an idea that we have this rules-based framework for how big of the position is going to be as a function of what our analyst thinks and what our models think. The right side of the page shows how that translates into a portfolio conceptually. So we think about our portfolio as a core satellite. The core of our portfolio are our best ideas, and those are the stocks where our analysts and our quantitative models agree that a stock is really attractive. Not only do we get better returns from those stocks, but because we have human analysts looking at them, we have much lower model error, and we're able to take bigger positions because we have less risk that the model's going to get something wrong. However, risk management is very important to us, and if all we did was build that core portfolio, the portfolio would be too concentrated, and it might not have all the risk controls we want. So we surround that core with a satellite, and that satellite has two types of companies. The first type is shown in the medium green. Those are the stocks that rank really well in our quant models that the analysts don't have a formal rating on. And those stocks tend to be really attractive to us because when our analysts don't have a rating, it typically means that it's an underfollowed, undercovered stock in the industry, because if we're not covering it, very few managers are. And our quant models tend to work very well there. So we can find really attractive stocks in any part of the market using our quantitative process.
David, quick question. Do you exclude any sectors where quant isn't necessarily always as reliable from that approach, i.e. biotech, REITs, etc.?
Yep. Thank you for the question. You're going to give the presentation for me.
Okay.
if you look at the bottom left of that circle where there's a light green slice with the arrow saying fundamental buy, there are also parts of the portfolio where we rely 100% on the fundamental analysts because we don't think the quantitative models apply. Biotech is an example. So within biotech, we have a team of SMID biotech analysts. The head of the team has a PhD from Johns Hopkins. There's no quant model that I've ever seen that can predict single drug binary outcomes. So for that, we throw away the quant model and rely totally on the fundamental analysts. Another
is it
area
still used as just a idea generation.
Not for biotech. We rely 100% on the fundamental team. No role whatsoever for the quant model.
Thank you.
Other types of stocks that would fit that role would be early stage growth companies, like early stage software, where traditionally quant models don't really know how to deal with them because those stocks either look like they're negative earners or it looks like they're too expensive because they're still ramping into their growth. And because quant models don't know how to deal with stocks like that, you often hear that quants tend to have a value bias. One of the ways we've gotten around that is we've actually got a proprietary growth factor in our quant model. But the other way we get around that is when we have really high conviction growth ideas from our fundamental platform, even if the quant model doesn't look attractive, we'll still take small positions in those top ideas because it helps generate alpha and it also balances the portfolio really well. So the consequence of this is that we have this core of the portfolio with these quant fundamental intersection buys, but then we have a really thoughtfully designed satellite that leverages both the quant model and our fundamental analysts to make sure that we're putting other really attractive names into the portfolio that also help us manage risk at the portfolio level. And I know I said a lot there, but let me just quickly pause and see if there are any questions about this.
Could you talk about the fundamental analysts' access to the quant model? Like, are they able to view the rankings prior to their fundamental analysts of said stock, let's say?
Yeah, so there's two core principles here that are both really important. The first is that the hallmark of T. Rowe's culture is collaboration. So there is 100% transparency and very frequent collaboration between the quant and fundamental analyst teams. The second, though, is that the views have to be independent, because if there was implicit pressure for the analyst to fall in line with the quant model, we would lose the benefit of diversification. So the way it works in practice is that there's a two-directional communication. The fundamental analysts are able to see all of our quant scores in a centralized system that we have at T. Rowe. On top of that, they talk to us all the time. So they'll come to us and say, you know, here's a stock we really like and your quant model doesn't like it. What are you seeing that we're not seeing, and can we hash it out together? They'll also come to us and say, I'm looking to cover new companies. please tell me what names I don't cover in my industry that are really attractive to you, and maybe I'll use that as a starting point. Conversely, I read all of the analyst notes that they put out because they published the notes on all their companies. So I'll read all the notes and then I talk to them. So every day, like all day long, I'm talking to the analysts to try to get more color on the names that they're rating and really divine the sentiment behind their ratings. So there's this bi-directional collaboration, but at the end of the day, they can't influence the quant model. And we tell them specifically, we don't want the quant model to influence their fundamental research because we really need the independence of viewpoints. Does that answer the question, Gwen?
Yes, thank you.
Don,
just one more.
Sorry, go ahead.
Just a quick question. How does this process change in an emergent situation, like when the market regime has changed and things are going down in the whole market? So, you know, does this process change much under different kind of macro market conditions, or do you kind of hold the process through that?
We hold the process through it because it's been demonstrated to work very well in different environments. When I get to kind of the performance of the process, you'll see that it's worked well in up and down markets. It's worked well in growth and value markets. And one reason for that is that we try to take a lot of stock specific risk and we try to neutralize a lot of the factor and sector and industry risk. So we're going to always be very tight to the benchmark on things like sectors and industries, which allows this to work well in different environments. What I will say is in a true period of secular change, like AI disruption, we'll rely a little bit more on the fundamental analyst because that's an area where the quant model, we're aware of the limitations of quant models. And so there's certain periods where the quant models work really well and other periods where you need to rely on the analyst a little bit more. And we've got an attribution document that we can show you at the end of the call that explains that.
Thank you.
Just one question. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say about a 5-minute check.
Yep.
Okay.
To David.
In terms of the model developing, you know, what's the process for, say, adding a new feature to the quantitative screen? When was the last time you looked at something like that? You know, what kind of resources are you given to continually be trying to update the quantitative model?
So we're always doing research on the quantitative model. It's an evolutionary process. We have, as you saw earlier, a full team of analysts working under the direction of the senior members of the team. So, you know, I'll give you an example of like one of the really cool projects we're doing right now is we're using natural language processing techniques to score all of our analyst notes. So right now, all of our analysts have buy and sell ratings, but they also put out all these notes. And you can start getting more granularity within the buy and sell ratings by doing natural language processing to divine the sentiment of the notes. So that's an example. In the interest of time, I'd love to go into more detail, but suffice it to say, we have a bunch of projects going on at any given time, and we might end up with 1 to 2 kind of model enhancements in any given year.
Thank you so much.
Yep. So a couple things I want to quickly hit. If we go to page 27, here's what the portfolio looks like. The top left of the page show you the largest weights. The point there is that this is a well-diversified portfolio. On the one hand, we take more meaningful positions than typical quant managers do because of our fundamental component. So we are taking meaningful positions in the names we like the best. However, it's much more diversified than most fundamental strategies. So as you can see, the largest weights are about 80 to 100 basis points. And we find that that's a really good level of diversification that balances, you know, conviction with risk management. If you look at the top right, you can see our sector weights, and we're very tight to the benchmark. This goes back to the earlier question that we're not trying to make macro calls. So we try to mirror the benchmark in terms of the systematic risk. Third thing I'd point out is we get the question at the bottom, the characteristics. A lot of people ask us whether we're value or growth, and the answer is we're actually both. So if you look at the first two rows, there are two growth metrics, and you can see that we're in line to higher than the benchmark in terms of growth. If you look at the third and fourth rows, those are two valuation metrics, and we're cheaper than the benchmark. And if you look at the fifth and sixth, where you've got two metrics of quality and profitability, we're about double that of the benchmark. So what this process has allowed us to do is to deliver higher growth and higher quality at a discount to the market. So you can think about it as like a very high quality GARP type strategy. Moving ahead quickly to page 33, this shows our annual track record. And obviously we're proud of the track record, but what I think is really important, it goes back to the question about different market environments. You can see that we've been able to outperform pretty consistently in a wide range of market environments, up and down markets. When we've underperformed, generally the underperformance hasn't been that significant. I would say that the one obvious question here is 2020, where there was underperformance. And that was really directly from March 2020 to March 2021 during the big post-COVID junk rally, where we underperformed then, but I think there was a big lesson that we took away. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to go into detail, but we learned a lot about how the market structure had changed during COVID with all these retail traders trading at home with options, et cetera. And we've made a bunch of risk management enhancements to our process so that something like that doesn't happen again. And I would highlight that, in the last year or two, we've been in a very similar speculative risk on environment and the portfolio has held up much better. Looking at page 34, another chart just to give you an idea of how we've historically performed in different environments. We've taken the track record of the strategy since inception, and we've bucketed it according to what the market did. So this is rolling 12-month periods where the left side are the biggest down markets, the right side are the biggest up markets, and the bar shows you our realized alpha. And what you'll see is that number one, we've been able to generate alpha in most market environments. But number two, the choppier, more challenging the market, the more alpha and downside protection we've historically been able to deliver. Whereas on the right side, in these bigger risk on environments, we've been able to keep up largely, although we have underperformed, for example, in 2020 and this year to date. So if you were to hire us and look up for the next 10 years, my best expectation would be that in really positive markets, we would deliver competitively positive returns, but we might be in line or slightly lag the benchmark. And in more challenging environments where our quality and our valuation discipline pay off, we would be able to provide better protection in those environments. I know we're tight on time. There's one more thing I wanted to show. John, do you mind pulling up the file that Brian sent you? Due to the loveliness of compliance, there's some things we haven't been able to put into the presentation, but this is a really important chart that I think also makes this come to life. So we have a detailed attribution system that, among other things, looks at how much value are we getting from the quant model and how much are we getting from the analyst platform. The left side of the page shows you the last four calendar years, what our performance has been relative to the benchmark. What's more important is the right side of the page, where we've decomposed the impact of our quant model in green and our fundamental platform in orange. What you'll see here, number one, is that both of them have worked well. They've both been positive three of the last 4 years. Secondly, the one time that each one was negative was the best year for the other one. So in 2022, when the Fed was raising rates and higher growth stocks rolled over, it was a very valuation sensitive, high quality environment. Our fundamental analyst with a little bit of a growth bias underperformed slightly, but the quant model in green was very, very strong. Fast forward to 2025, where there is a pretty low quality rally that was challenging for a lot of quant managers. Our analysts did a really good job because they got in on the AI beneficiaries before the rest of the market had noticed them. And they did some really great stock selection in biotech. And so even though the quant model was a little bit weaker that year, the fundamental analysts did very well. And so hopefully what this demonstrates is when we put quant and fundamental together, it's not just that the intersection is additive, but they work at different times. And that's been another driver of the consistent track record we've had. I know we're up against time, but let me just quickly see if there are any questions about things I've presented. Okay. If not, the way I would summarize it is this is an institutional quality process that takes two proprietary alpha sources, puts them together. The sum is better than the individual parts. They work at different times. We wrap it all with risk management, and then the value proposition for our clients should be steady, reasonably steady, consistent outperformance over most market cycles, along with style purity and a lack of big surprises.
Thanks much. We appreciate it. You talk very quickly.
Well, when they told me we had less time, I figured I would just talk more quickly and get the information.
Yeah, a lot of information in a short period. All right. Thanks much. You all are excused. We appreciate your time and effort. Should we take a brief break?
Thank you for about five minutes.
Thanks much. Take care.
Sure.
All right, let's come back at 9:50, and we'll get two more in, and then we can take our last break. Okay?
Thank you.
So we'll see everybody at 9:50 Mountain Standard Time. Thanks.
A long way since you used to catch me falling asleep at these things, huh?
Is the drinking fountain still out in the hall?
We actually have a water dispenser right here. There should be cups on top of it, too, if you don't want to drink water that tastes like City Hall pipes.
But you're selling the best water. You aren't selling it in bottles.
No.
So it's supposed to be.
I'm not saying city water is bad, just City Hall water tastes bad.
Okay. Where is that?
The water dispenser is right here. Right on the other side of that partition. Checking. I thought there were. Are you back? There's.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Sylvia, are you there at this moment? Guess not. Let's get back to it. Is everybody back? Okay. Do we have our Vanguard group here? Okay.
Hi. Good morning.
Hang on one second. We're going to ask you to keep your remarks to about 40 minutes. So let's shoot to be done about 10:30 Mountain Standard Time. I'm not sure where you all are locally, but 40 minutes from now. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. You. Take it away.
Great. Thank you. And good morning, everyone. We are, me and my colleague, Matt Giagino, are so excited to be here with you and to speak with you. We are on the East Coast here. So again, just really appreciate the time. Quickly, by way of introduction, my name is Chelsea Westhoff. I've had the privilege of spending the last 21 years here at Vanguard, all working directly with our institutional clients and consultant partners at Callen. So again, appreciate the time. I know the focus for this morning is on the Vanguard Strategic Equity Fund. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen here, and I'll let my colleague Matt introduce himself. He's a senior portfolio manager and will be doing the majority of talking today. What I would say is please interject with questions. We would love for this to be a conversation and are happy to go in any direction you feel best. So with that said, I'll go ahead and share my screen. And Matt, I will quickly turn it over to you.
Thank you all for the time today. Matt Giannino, basically operates a client portfolio manager. I was a portfolio manager on the team that manages this portfolio. Now I kind of operate as a liaison between that team and folks like yourself to talk about their portfolios and what they do. Please, as I go along, if there are any questions, please interrupt me. I'm happy to answer any questions as we go along. So Strategic Equity Fund, Vanguard's active mid to small cap offering, priced at 17 basis points. As you can see from this slide, the performance of the portfolio has been pretty good against both the benchmark, the market, and against peers. What I would say is the key here is what we are trying to do is, in a systematic driven approach, we are trying to capture the way that a fundamentally focused portfolio manager would approach investing and do it with risk control. And what that leads to, as you can see here, is not only can we generate consistent alpha or consistent outperformance over long periods of time, we tend to be able to do it in most markets. In this environment, volatility, and you have the market being driven by momentum and outsized returns from single stocks, the risk control and the way we build our portfolios allows us to be diversified and control those risks so that no single stock or no single risk factor will tend to overwhelm our portfolio, which can be pretty critical in the types of markets that we have experienced over the last few years. Chelsea, if you want to move on to the team. So the quantitative equity team, they are Vanguard's internal active portfolio manager. Vanguard typically works with the best portfolio managers in the world, both externally and internally. Those managers could be firms like Wellington, PrimeCap. So we go out and hire managers to run money for us, but we also have an internal team that we will leverage if we feel like the mandate fits their particular skill set. The team is headed up by Cesar Orozco, who works with his team to set the research agenda, to allocate resources across the team. Scott Rotimer is the head of US Alpha. His team would be responsible for the day-to-day operations of this portfolio and for basically working to set the research agenda that would go into enhancing the strategies over time. They have their own trading team headed up by Robert Luca. That team works integrally with Vanguard's internal trading teams, but they are focused specifically on trading active strategies. The important thing here is you see there are 25 strategists, analysts, and portfolio managers. They are backed by Vanguard's resources. So Vanguard handles middle office for the team. Vanguard handles back office for the team. Vanguard also provides additional IT resources as needed. So you could almost think of this team as a boutique manager operating inside big Vanguard, being able to leverage those resources so that they can focus just on the portfolio management and research necessary to run their portfolios. As far as resourcing goes, the 25 strategists and analysts are responsible for the first and foremost the day-to-day operations of the portfolio. So that would be managing cash flow, handling turnover. Any research projects, the resources are allocated across the team based on skill set and based on the nature of the project. So Scott Rotimer could be borrowing resources from Sharon's team, from Rob Luca's team, in order to help him with any research projects he might be kicking off for his portfolios. Any questions broadly on the team? So if we move to the next slide, basically this just highlights that the team has been running money for Vanguard since 1991 across and has skills across various different mandates. That includes, we have quantitative equity. That is the type of strategy that we're going to be talking about today, where it's long only investing in equity markets. They also have portfolios that focus on specific factors in the market, liquid alternatives, as well as do some things within the commodity space. Maybe Chelsea move to the model itself and we'll get into exactly what they're doing on slide 8. I think the numbers are a little bit off. Go up. We're missing a page here. Yeah, there's a page missing, Chelsea. You can go back up to, since that page is missing, go back up to, I think it's going to be one before the team, I think, had the model on it. There we go. Apologies for that. So as I mentioned in the intro, the team is basically attempting to build a process that captures the way that a fundamental analyst would approach analyzing securities, but be able to do it at scale. Basically, what that allows us to do is to analyze every security within the universe that we are managing money to. In this case, it's about 2,200 names that represent the large and or small and mid-cap part of the market. So an analyst, typically what they can do is go deep on a single security, but they can't analyze every security. What we're trying to do is analyze every stock and be able to build a risk-controlled portfolio that is diversified across many stocks to capture the characteristics that we think are most important to drive returns in a stock. So what we're trying to do first and foremost is find companies with management teams that have demonstrated the ability to generate growth year over year over year. What we've found is that those companies are more likely to be able to sustain that growth and therefore outperform their peers. So we start there. Now we want to make sure that what we're seeing is sustainable. So we're going to look at the overall balance sheets and income statements of these companies. What we want to see are management teams that are able to basically turn over the assets of those companies consistently, don't have a heavy debt load, but basically they have the financial statements that can support that growth going forward. We're next looking at the overall capital structure of these companies. What we want to see are management teams that are investing in their businesses commensurate with the level of growth that they're generating. So what we do is we build a mosaic of companies that compete with this company, understand how those companies are investing and then compare the level of investment the company is doing to the level of growth that they're generating. So companies that are investing enough to sustain that growth are more likely to be able to succeed. Companies that are overinvesting have a tendency to be too confident and tend to underperform or undershoot their growth rates. And management teams that are then underinvesting, the signal there would be that they're worried that they're not going to be able to generate the same level of growth going forward. Next, we look to the markets. And what we want to see here is what are other investors doing? Everything that we've been talking about right now is backward looking. We want to get somewhat of a forward view. So what we want to see are what are analysts thinking? How are they evaluating these securities? What's the market thinking in terms of how are they pricing the growth that we're seeing in the market? And here, we're not just talking about what is this company doing. We actually use, and this will be the, you know, when you hear AI, in this case, what we're using is machine learning. And what that allows us to do is build a mosaic of all of the company's competitors, all of their suppliers, and all of their customers. And what we can see is how is the market evaluating that cohort. And what we want to see is a company that's doing well on its own, or the market sees it as doing well, its competitors are doing well, its customers are doing well, and its suppliers are doing well. That would tell us that this is in a, the company is in a healthy industry, and everything that's around it is healthy. Next, we're going to look again to the markets, and what we want to understand are what are smart investors thinking. Are these investors shorting the stock? Are these investors buying options against the stock? That would tell us that what we're seeing other investors may think is fragile and not sustainable. Lastly, we're going to look to the valuation of the company. So now we're seeing all of these great characteristics. This company is generating good growth. The management team is investing properly in the companies. Other investors are seeing the same thing that we're seeing in the company. We want to then make sure that we're going to pay a reasonable price for that company. What will then happen is all these characteristics that I'm talking about here will come together to form an overall expected return for every security in the universe of stocks that we're managing to. Any questions on that? If no questions, then I'll talk about how we then go about constructing the overall portfolio. So you could probably stay right here, Chelsea. This is fine. No, I'm sorry. Go to the slide you had up that had the risk control on it. Keep going. Right there, just stay there. So now that we have these expected returns, what we're then going to do is build a portfolio that basically maximizes our exposure to those expected returns. So you could think of it as we're going to look at companies against companies that like companies and find the companies that we think are going to generate the best returns going forward. And we're going to build a portfolio that maximizes our exposure to those companies. We're going to do it, though, in a risk-controlled way. So what we're saying is we're going to look at the benchmark. In this case, it's a mid-small benchmark. We want to make sure that, look, we're going to deliver you that return. And then we want to deliver you alpha on top of that return so that you and your constituents are getting the beta first and foremost, and then you're getting our alpha on top of it. So what we're asking, we have a what's called an optimizer. It's basically a risk model that has all these different characteristics built into it. And we're asking you to say, to build us a portfolio that maximizes our alpha while controlling underlying risks. In this case, those risks would be sectors and industries. As you can see from this page, those sectors and industries are going to be very tightly risk controlled. We're going to ask it to minimize our exposure to any individual security so that no security on its own should be able to blow up the portfolio's return. So basically, we're saying we're going to hold a position in a stock relative to its weight within the index in a way that the risk of that single stock does not contribute too much to our overall portfolio. And then we're going to control things like known risk factors like size and volatility and characteristics like that. I saw a hand come up with a question.
Yeah, this is Tarleton. Just a quick question. And
sure.
Correct. Hopefully this is a fair kind of summary, but it sounds like you guys are very committed to breadth, like having a good breadth understanding of the market and analyzing the entire universe of the companies that you're looking at. And then you're also very committed to staying within the stylistic measure of the benchmark, right?
Correct.
And you also use language models as you're kind of digging in and evaluating within a sector or how a specific company is doing. I guess my question is, you know, for each of these different sectors that each have their own potential like boutique group that is focused on them, is it a consistent process across each of them? And how do you oversee that? I guess I am interested in knowing like how much of that is centralized and how much are you leaning on those and what those dynamics look like in terms of using these tools versus kind of the fundamental approach.
So in each sector, depending on the, well, put it simply, we start off with here's our philosophy. Here's how we think that most companies should behave. We will then look at each individual sector or industry group and determine whether we should adjust the process or adjust the model to reflect unique characteristics within that industry or sector. For example, within technology or within biotech, R&D are critical. And so we are going to adjust the model to reflect that fact and capture capture companies that are investing prudently into their businesses. So we will adjust the model to reflect the different sectors and industry groups' uniqueness. The other thing I should say, we talked about machine learning in the sentiment portion of the model. We also use machine learning to assess the current market environment and economic environment. And what that then allows the model to do is to adjust the underlying characteristics that it would deem most important for a particular stock in a given market or industry or market or economic environment. Put oversimplistically, let's say that I've got two companies. They both have fairly heavy debt loads. And we are in a high and rising rate environment. Company A's management team has historically struggled to handle that debt load in an environment like that. So what the model would likely do is focus more on that company's ability to generate cash flow in order to service that debt load. Company B never has a problem, always is able to manage its debt load. And so the model for company B may not adjust anything.
So the models are both sector specific and adapt to the company's kind of situation. Is that accurate?
Adapt to the company's situation based on what we're seeing, what the model is seeing in the current market environment and economic environment. Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And again, I touched on the very beginning about us trying to mimic at scale what a fundamental manager or fundamental analyst can do. And this, you know, what we're now able to do and more and more all the time, a lot of our researchers is along that way, is utilize machine learning and potentially utilize AI to go deeper and deeper on single companies, which is not something you are really able to do prior to both computing power, mainly computing power, and the availability of these large data sets. But we are getting closer and closer.
About the resources?
I'm sorry?
Can you talk a little bit more about the resources and the spend and the sort of, I guess there's a bit of an arms race in these areas. How are you working to stay at the front edge?
Yeah, I mean, this goes back to what I mentioned about having Vanguard's IT infrastructure behind us. So obviously, our teams, our portfolio managers and researchers, we have people who understand machine learning and AI deeply. But we also have data scientists provided to us by Vanguard that help us go even deeper. Now, they work with us to learn the finance side of it. Obviously, they don't necessarily have the same finance chops as we might have, but they've got really, really deep machine learning and AI expertise that we can leverage. The other thing is, as far as spend goes, yes, Vanguard's providing us with a budget that we will then utilize to basically access data sets that we can then use to continue to enhance the processes. What I would say is, the important thing for us along this journey is making sure that everything we do makes economic and financial sense. One, so we set everything we do has priors to it. So basically, how do we think things should happen? And making sure that whatever we're doing aligns with those priors. The other part of it is we have to be able to understand it, the output that comes from it. We have to be able to explain it to others. So we don't just, you might have heard the term, throw spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. That's not what we're doing in our process. So for us, it's taken a long time to really build this out because of those things that we have to have in order to make it happen. But that is, I mean, there is, I would argue that we're probably at the forefront of this and our ability to leverage it because to some extent, we have a unique question we are trying to answer. And I will also say everything that we have done so far has been built internally. We are not using off-the-shelf large language models. We are not using off-the-shelf. We are building everything internally to fit our unique problem.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But what I will say is what we get now is, like I said, an expected return then basically for every stock in the universe. And that's basically our forward-looking view on how we think that stock is going to perform. And then we can build a portfolio where you're basically trading off an IT stock against an IT stock, or you're trading off an industrial stock against an industrial stock, in building your portfolio. But we are also tightly risk controlled, as you pointed out. What that means is if we don't like a name, we're going to only be underweighted relative to its benchmark weight within a range. So you see here the largest holdings in the portfolio, 80 basis points, 70 basis points. We're not going to have large positions in single stocks. So what that means is no single stock should be contributing an outsized return to the portfolio, both positive and negatively. So if there is a stock in the market that has an outsized risk contributor, we will likely hold it in order to offset that risk. That's why you've seen in an environment that has been fairly difficult for a lot of active managers, we've been able to do pretty well. And a lot of that, not only has the alpha done well, but the risk control has helped us, you know, so that we're not being exposed to stocks that are up 300, 500, 1,000%. Besides the risk control that you're seeing on this page, the other thing you will notice is the model coming through. So typically, we are going to have a valuation discount relative to the benchmark. And you can see that in the PE discount, the price earnings discount on this page. But we are fundamentally focused. So you'll not normally not see a price to book discount. Price to book typically means highlights companies in distress. That's not what we're holding here. We're not deep value managers. We are basically growth managers, relative price growth managers.
Got it. Okay.
And you'll also typically see we'll have a growth rate better than the market. We'll have returns on earnings and returns on assets better than the market. So what you're going to see is fundamentally growth focused with a valuation discount, all depending, again, on how that valuation, how that growth is being priced in the market.
Looks like we have another question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Hi. Regarding the blend between Wellington and the internal quantitative team, how is capital allocated between like subcategories, and has that been steady or has that allocation changed over time? And then who has the final say on individual names to purchase?
Yes. So the quantitative equity team is the sole manager on this portfolio, and they are making all decisions on the when to turn over the portfolio and how to construct the portfolio. This is a Vanguard only strategy. So there's no Wellington involvement with this one. The allocation to each sector, industry, single stock, that's going to be determined by the model. So basically, they if they need to turn over the portfolio or invest cash, they're going to say, ask the question of a risk model to say, I want to maximize my alpha, but I want to control these risks. Give me a portfolio that does that for me. So the portfolio managers, what they're doing is they're evaluating the exposure they have to the overall alpha in the model, and comparing that to where they could take it and the transaction costs they would generate in order to get there. So they want to make sure that they're managing those transaction costs so that they can maximize the overall alpha in the portfolio over time.
Yeah.
This is a true systematic process. There is no portfolio manager override only in this. Well, the only time that they would are typically if there's a capital event that happened in the market that would call into question the model's ability to assess it. They might remove that security from a buy or a sell list. The other case would be if there is an outsized risk in the market that they feel like they need to control. And the easiest example would go back to the meme stocks in the days where you had stocks like AMC and things like that, that all of a sudden got to a large weight. And not only a large weight, but they are incredibly volatile. They might hold a position, a neutral position in that name, so that the risk would not overwhelm the portfolio. So that's where the skill of the managers would come in.
So just for clarity, you said this is a very systemic system. So for kind of those boutique contributors, they're basically helping set up the system correctly. Is that the right way to describe that?
Everyone on the team kind of thinks about the world, takes a fundamental lens of thinking about the world or thinking about the markets. And then the process is, okay, well, how do we go about and apply that and apply it systematically? Okay. So a lot of the research now is around, can we understand what is most important to investors in the market at a given time? And that's one of the things that AI and ML are helping us to understand, is trying to better understand those conditions. But that's, but outside of the portfolio management part of it and implementing the strategy, the rest of their time is thinking about ways to enhance the strategy. How can we, what parts of the model can we improve and how can we improve it? So basically, how can we get better insight? How can we improve that expected return expectation or get more confidence around it?
Okay.
But I would say the biggest difference between us and a true fundamental manager is conviction. A true fundamental manager has high conviction in their ability to forecast the return for a single stock. We don't have that level of conviction on a single name. What we have conviction in is our ability to assess what characteristics are most important to a company over time and diversifying across multiple companies in order to get exposure to those characteristics.
Yeah.
Our belief is if we can buy 10 companies, we can generate excess returns because those 10 companies will diversify risk and give us that and make sure we are right. So we're trying to be right, whatever it is, 55% or 60% of the time. And if we can do that, we feel like we can generate consistent long-term alpha without getting in trouble because risk factors overwhelm us.
I'm just looking at the time. I know we have just about 8 minutes or so left. Thank you so much for the questions. Maybe just with the time we have left, Matt, if you wanted to share any thoughts and, to the group where you would like Matt to spend the remainder of the time. We want to make sure all your questions are answered.
I guess, can you discuss a little bit of the turnover rate that's listed on this page here and just kind of if there are any like guardrails set up within the model for that?
Yeah, it's typically we're turning the portfolio over about 4% a month. That the model tends to degrade on a 12 to 16 month time frame, 12 to 18 month time frame. And so what we found through experience is that if we can turn the portfolio over 4%, that maintains our exposure to the model in the portfolio, but also controls the overall transaction costs. Obviously, to the extent we get cash flow, we can continually invest that cash flow to improve the portfolio as well. But that's pretty much what we've found. Now, if there are market dislocations, there are things that happen and the portfolio alpha degrades significantly and we feel like we need to turn over the portfolio more, we will. But it's really that balance between the alpha the improvement to the overall exposure or expected return of the portfolio relative to the transaction costs we would need to generate to improve that portfolio. And that's the trade-off we continually make daily.
I did have a question about your portfolio managers. It seems you've had a number of changes in portfolio managers or lost a few in the last 5 years. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, it is. This is truly a team approach. Like I said, the portfolio managers on the fund on at a given time are there they're the ones who understand how to, you know, understand the space, understand the portfolio, understand how to manage the cash flow, understand what I was talking about, the balance between transaction costs and alpha generation. So they're basically handling the day-to-day operations. Research, like I mentioned, is spread across the entire team. So no single individual really is necessarily so important to the overall research process or to the model's development or to the building of the portfolio. The expectation would be that if someone was not here to manage the portfolio, someone else can step in pretty easily and take over the day-to-day operations. But that said, Scott and Cesar, as leaders of that team, obviously we trust them as leaders and trust them in their ability as researchers in order to drive the overall development of the model going forward.
Would you say it's quite a different position of how portfolio managers normally participate in these kinds of funds? Like it's just due to the nature of the instrument. Is that a fair statement?
That's fair. I mean, it is, look, if something were to happen to Cesar and Scott tomorrow, the model would continue to run and do its job. Now, what we would want to do is make sure that we can find somebody that we can bring in to help improve and enhance it. But that's really what their job is. Their primary job is to look at the model today and understand how can we possibly, you know, making sure we have the right people, make sure we have the right talent on the team, and make sure that necessary to continue to enhance and improve that model, and then set the research agenda needed to continue to enhance and improve it. But we're pretty confident we have a pretty good model in place now. What we're trying to do is figure out ways that we can make it even better.
Thank you.
But you're not losing that. You're not losing that stock selection capability and expertise that you would be buying in a portfolio manager.
Right.
Any other questions or comments? I want to be respectful of everybody's time and thank you for the engagement so far. I know we have a minute or two left.
I guess one more question. So relative to some other firms, you do have relatively higher standard deviations reported. Could you speak a little bit to that? Does that impact risk much? If that's something we've seen.
Look, if you look at the underlying risk characteristics of the portfolio, we're going to look very close to the benchmark on most of them. Some of that's going to be the fact that the portfolio has performed so well in recent years, and that's going to drive some variability relative to the benchmark.
Just from the upward side, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of one directional. It's been kind of moved in one direction for the last 3 to 5, 3 years or so, 4 years. And people ask about expectations. Look, you know, we're running this portfolio somewhere between 3% and 5% tracking error, closer to 3% tracking error or variability relative to the benchmark. If we're good at what we do and can generate, we would expect to be able to generate 100 basis points a year on top of that. But what we've seen, obviously, of late is that, as you just said, all of that's been in one direction and you kind of just compound on itself. So we're generating positive returns like we would expect. We're taking on the amount of risk that we would expect. It's just that the market is continuing to reward what we are doing in the portfolio. And so those excess returns just continue to compound.
Okay. Thank you all very, very much for your time. We very much appreciate it. And we will, of course, give you due consideration. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the time. And feel free to shoot any questions over to Callan and they'll get them to us as well. So thank you very much.
Great.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay. Next up is Loomis Sayles and Company. Are you all here?
I just messaged them to join, so they should be joining any second now. Yeah.
Okay.
Take your bed.
Don't.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Welcome. We are ready to go. We have allotted about 40 minutes, so figure on, let's see, it is 10:30 Mountain Standard Time, figure about 11:10 to 11:15. We've eaten a couple of minutes into your time. Okay.
Thank you, Mark. And I may wait for my colleague Joe to join. I know we just received Gwen's email. I'm sure he's refreshing currently. Okay. As a matter of fact, I think he popped in before maybe and then jumped out. So I'm hoping it's only a minute.
Not a problem.
Otherwise, I'll do my best Joe Gatz impression, which.
So figure about.
I'll be listening to the recording.
About 11:15.
Okay.
For you to have any water or anything, let me know and I'll go get it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Just don't want you guys to miss anything. Escape.
as a note, we have now interviewed two more quantitative candidates. Now we're going to move into a more fundamental process. So there will be a change in the discussion points.
Thank you for that, Eugene. And hi, welcome, Joe.
Hello. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, excellent. So, Joe, Mark kindly has established some time parameters for us. We'll go till just about 15 minutes past the hour, right at 40 minutes. And Joe and I previously discussed, and we'll plan to keep our comments to about approximately 25 to 30 minutes to be sure we leave some time for question and answers. First, by way of introductions, my name is John Meyer, and I run our public fund business at Loomis Sayles. I'm joined by Joe Gatz, portfolio manager on the SMID Core strategy. And we really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all. You know, I believe we presented a core fixed income strategy several years ago, and that was in Tucson. And so this travel, I suppose, was a little bit easier, but also a little bit less beautiful. But again, we really appreciate the opportunity, all the folks at Callan have done, and for the board's consideration. I'll just quickly provide you with some context about the firm that I think will help maybe as Joe goes through the specifics of the small and mid-cap core strategy. I have a presentation up. Would it be helpful if I share it, or does everybody have it on their screens?
I think you should go ahead and share.
Okay, will do.
Thank you.
Bear with me. I should be able to do this, but let's find out. Okay, does that work? Now you can see my whole screen, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
Okay. I think that's, let me see if I can resize this. If there are embarrassing texts that come in from my wife, I hope you'll forgive me. That happens. Okay, good. Is that sized appropriately? Everyone feels okay about that?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. Right. So thank you for bearing with me on that. So Loomis Sayles is headquartered out of Boston, and I would categorize the firm as sort of a mid-sized investment management company with just over $400 billion in assets under management. We are proud to have just hit our 100-year mark, which means very little for prospective investors looking to invest with us into the future, but it does at least, I think, speak some to the stability of the firm and the long legacy of the firm in being an investment manager that is focused on deep research. The majority of our client base is institutional, so we are not a large retail investment manager. We are not a large provider, for example, of ETFs or large mutual funds or a record keeper. We're focused predominantly on working with large institutional investors, much like yourselves. We've organized our investment teams to be specialized and individual and highly focused investment management teams that can employ their investment process in a way that's supported by centralized resources like myself or like trading or like compliance. And we feel like this gives us a bit of an edge in mixing both the boutique focus and nimbleness of specialized teams with the stability of a diversified asset manager. And Jill will go a little bit more into the team structure there. Back to the piece about being an institutional asset manager, and we think this is a really important consideration as you think of prospective managers to partner with. We take our client servicing role very seriously, and you'll notice that the public fund business working with large public pools such as yourselves is a very large piece of our business with upwards of $50 billion. It's a significant portion of our assets, and it really has been our legacy. It's how we've grown much of our business, and it's how we have organized our relationship management teams. You'll see that we have several 60-plus credit client service professionals, for example, engaged with our public fund team. And we'd like to take a highly collaborative approach, both with consultants ensuring timely information and responsiveness, as well as understanding what large investors like yourselves are looking for with their managers in terms of reporting and interaction with the board. And with that, so long as there are no questions on the firm, I'll turn it over to Joe to speak specifically about the SMID and mid-core equity strategy. Okay, Joe, take it away.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect, John. Thank you for sharing the screen there. Maybe I'll just start with maybe somewhat what others are thinking. I noticed you have 1,225 text messages on your computer there. That's very impressive, John. So
I'm a popular guy. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I can say anything that's going to, you know, top that today. But in any regard, thank you for the opportunity today to present our small mid equity strategy. My name is Joe Gatz. I'm the lead portfolio manager of our small mid product and product team. We have a short presentation today here outlining our team, our strategy, our performance, our positioning. And since it's on video, I will keep an eye on the screen here. I will pause from time to time in case there are questions along the way. But if everything goes to plan and I stay on track here, we should leave time at the end for questions as well. So, yeah, so let's get started. I see we're on slide 8 here, perfect place to start. And our focus today is on the small mid equity strategy. This product was launched at Loomis Sayles in 1998. And I have been the lead portfolio manager since January of 2000. The team also, I should point out, manages a small cap strategy that was launched in 1991. The SMID strategy today, just to update, the assets under management are just almost $1.7 billion AUM spread across a variety of public funds, Taft-Hartley, pensions, endowments, et cetera. And our estimated capacity is about $5 billion in AUM. So plenty of headroom there. just a note, the small cap portfolio we manage is similarly sized. Two points I want to make about this is that both products are managed by the same team in an identical fashion and strategy. The strategies are the same for both. The team members' portfolio management assignments are the same. Characteristics are very similar. Both are our stock selection, very bottom-up, one stock at a time driven strategies. There's about 35% overlap between the two. We do take that into account when we consider the capacity of the two products. The primary differences between the two, obviously, number one would be market capitalization. The small mid product is benchmarked by most of our client base to the Russell 2500. And so the market cap range for that tends to range from roughly 200 million float on the low end up to as high as 15 billion in terms of market cap for new additions to the portfolio, whereas the small cap portfolio tops out around 8 or 9 billion in market cap. So the weighted average market cap of the small mid clearly is higher. The overlap between the two tends to be at the higher end of the small cap range, so there's no major liquidity issues there. And the second difference is the benchmark, as I mentioned, for the small mid strategy is the Russell 2500 versus for small cap, the Russell 2000 value. And so by putting wide guardrails around the benchmark sector weightings, preserving our ability to manage the portfolio in a stock selection driven fashion. That's truly how we attempt to add value and have over time. By benchmarking one versus the other, that the SMID portfolio tends to have fewer financials, REITs, utilities, a little bit more information technology, industrials, healthcare holdings. And so that's the primary difference between the two. And by putting those wide guardrails around the benchmarks, it keeps us true to our mandate as a core small mid equity strategy manager here. Let's just move ahead to slide 9. And this is our small mid equity team. And as you see from the page here, we have two co-portfolio managers, myself since January 2000, Jeff Schwartz since 2013. Five dedicated analysts. We've grown the team over the past 25 years. Roughly for the first 15 years of that period, we had two co-portfolio managers and three dedicated analysts. Now we have five. We're actually considering adding a sixth analyst to the team here, as we've had a really good experience with a summer intern who's sitting right outside of my office. All seven members of the team have research responsibility. So we divide up research roughly by economic sector. So I have a full coverage list of companies that I cover and have added to the portfolio, as does Jeff, Nate, Zach Borovic, and the three other analysts on the team. We've recently promoted Nate Henderson and Zach Borovic in March of this year to associate portfolio manager. Just recognizing their longer tenure on the team here, the strong contribution that they've made to the team, and just really to reflect the depth of resources that we have in hand. Continuity has been strong. Over the past 26 years, we've only had five departures on the team. None of these departures have gone directly to another investment manager. So we've kept the people that we wanted to keep, and excellent continuity, very stable organization. I think that's a reflection of the culture that we have here at the broader Loomis Sayles, not just on our team here, but the broader firm and entity, where we invest in our people, understanding that, you know, research and strong contribution on, at the individual level is a key to long-term success. Also, we have a product manager titled an investment director, Keith Weigel, who manages all things not related to investment research or portfolio management. So internal marketing, product management, external marketing, a variety of responsibilities goes along with that. And I'd also mention that while Loomis Sayles is headquartered in Boston, Massachusetts, our team primarily resides in southeastern Michigan. So the product, as I mentioned, was founded, you know, small cap in 1991, SMID in 1998. Here in the Detroit office of Loomis Sayles, I'm sitting in my office in a northern suburb of Detroit called Bloomfield Hills right now, along with the rest of my teammates. And so the product was founded here. All our research is here. And, you know, we trade through Boston, but we do have the resources and the ample resources of a large firm like Loomis Sayles, which brings us access to management and the tools that we need in terms of research budgets, travel, we go visit companies, and everything we need to do to get the job done here in terms of a stock selection driven portfolio. Okay, so this is where I'll pause for a minute. That's a, you know, quick overview of the assets under management, the account base, and the team. If there are any questions at this point, or I can move into a discussion on our portfolio strategy and investment philosophy.
I think moving into strategy and getting the sort of core understanding of how you do things is great, Joe. Thank you.
Let's go. Yeah, that's perfect. Well, you know, simply stated, yeah, and John, thank you for that slide there. We're perfect. We are investors and we're not traders. Of course, we trade the portfolio, turnover is about 35%, but we think of ourselves in terms of investors. So simply stated, we buy ownership stakes of small and medium-sized U.S. companies, and we through the public equity, and we try to pay meaningfully less than the true value of the enterprise, than what the enterprise is worth. So we have a long-standing process. We call it bottom-up research-driven process, meaning we're not making macroeconomic decisions here and rotating the portfolio sector by sector, or, you know, making a bet on interest rates or inflation or next week's GDP report or an employment number that's coming out in the next week. Instead, it's very organic in terms of we look at one business at a time, trying to understand the advantages, disadvantages of that business, the moat around that business, if it exists, the opportunity that the industry that it operates provides, and the capability of the management team. And we value those companies very carefully. I'll go into some detail about how we do that. And again, we only invest we find companies that meet the fundamental criteria that we require, and that when the stock is offering a meaningful discount to our assessment of what true intrinsic value is. So this provides a margin of safety. As we invest the portfolio, we're dealing with the future. There's a variety of outcomes that can occur. And so this provides us with a range of outcomes here, and putting the probability in our favor from day one. So investors not trading. So overall, while the market is generally efficient on the whole for a variety of reasons, individual stocks can deviate meaningfully from what we assess to be true intrinsic value. And we do believe that a repeatable process can identify enough candidates to build a diversified portfolio of stocks not properly valued in the market and deliver attractive long-term returns at an acceptable level of risk. We have some risk metrics later in the presentation that we'll look at. So it also requires patience for the market to come around to our way of thinking. And that's one of our advantages. So if you make a list of differentiating characteristics of our portfolio, first of all, it's an active strategy, very research driven. Second, we take a longer term perspective than the vast majority of other investors out there. If you look over the past 15, 20 years, the average holding period in the portfolio has been close to 4 years, much longer than what the market is doing today, you know, with hedge funds and pod shops and, you know, increased retail presence in the active in the market today. You know, the average investor is looking more like, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. And we're thinking in terms of 3 to 4 years in terms of accurately valuing these companies, finding companies that are really good businesses that we think will grow business value over time, management teams that we trust that can allocate capital on behalf of owners like us and our clients. And then we, you know, we're patient in terms of the ability for these stocks in the market to come around and revalue these back to closer to the level of intrinsic value that we've identified.
Could you, that's an interesting word, the patience, you know, as you have speculative capital that can come in sometimes in the speculative nature of the markets in small and mid, how do you view that? And how do you view staying patient, especially in a, you know, sort of 9,200 stock portfolio?
Yeah. You know, we're inundated with news all the time. And, you know, and in markets like today, where, you know, very concentrated areas of the market are performing very well at the expense of some other areas of the market. You know, we take that, all that information and those dislocations that we see in the market today that everyone sees. And, you know, we think of the market as being there to serve us, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, yes, we are patient. We're not infinitely patient. We do have expectations for our companies and the management teams, and we have a range of factors and metrics that we expect the companies to deliver. It's all part of our investment thesis. But, you know, we're not always going to be in sync with what the market's looking at and favors today. And instead of looking at that as being a negative, we look at that as a potential positive where, you know, we have a differentiated opinion that creates a valuation opportunity that we can take advantage of looking at underfollowed, misunderstood franchises and special situations in the market. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, you know, of course, buying and selling is like super important, but the magic really happens over the period that you hold the stock over a longer period of time. Yeah. So our approach is solidly in the core category. We invest across a range of investment styles, value, core to growth. We think that value companies that the fundamentals are strong enough meet our criteria, and companies that have a higher rate of growth rate, if we think that they're dislocated in terms of how they're valued, those are appropriate as well. We rely on individual stock selection to drive performance, with the intention of outperforming our benchmark, the Russell 2500 core benchmark, at a level in excess of the portfolio risk that we undertake. Great. So what are the characteristics of the businesses we like to invest in? You know, I think, John, if you skip ahead one more, how about one more? I'll come back to that one. Yeah, there we go. So this is kind of the detail of our fundamental research, which is really core to our approach. We have a quality orientation. We prefer fundamentally sound or improving businesses that can grow business value over time. And growing business value, meaning generating returns on capital or greater than their cost of capital employed, with reinvestment opportunities so they can grow organically. And to the extent that there's excess cash flow in the business, management teams that can appropriately allocate capital either organically within the business or return cash to shareholders through stock repurchase or dividends. And that leads us to the second key criteria here. There's several on this page here, but management capability is super important for us. So we talk to a lot of management teams every management, every management team holding in our portfolio, we've had discussions with in one form or fashion or another. And, you know, we look for capable and proven management teams that are trustworthy and appropriately align with us as shareholders. So, we look
given,
for
given management. Being in Detroit, do you get as much access to management as, say, your peers that might be located in, say, New York or Boston? Or do you tend to go out to management?
Well, there's two things I'll say about that. We do travel. We do visit. You know, we do get management teams coming through to visit us. We're a fairly large manager here. There's a handful of other managers here in southeastern Michigan. But between the seven investors on the team here, we do travel quite a bit. So to the extent that we need to see management, there's always someone actively, you know, virtually every week, you know, someone's on the road visiting a company or at a conference and having meetings with management. And, you know, the advent of video, I mean, maybe this meeting 10 years ago would not have been on video. Maybe we'd all would have been in Tucson. And so the world's kind of shrunk a little bit. So we do a lot of things like this with management teams as well. So, the last thing I'll say about that, because it's super interesting, there's a finite number of ideas we really need. And the key is that we get the ideas that we need. It's organic from our own team to generate those ideas. We don't rely on like a sell side or an outside firm to feed us ideas. It's very organic within our team. We have plenty of opportunity to invest in the portfolio. So there's no shortage of ideas or lack of opportunity. Yeah. So just to, put a...
One question.
Oh, please.
With your focus on management, how have you viewed kind of the management world changing over the last 5 years that you feel like you're kind of, a deeply connected team can better understand than, and that's often missed by other strategies?
I think you said something very true. It has changed over time. You know, we look at things like, you know, the track record of the management team in terms of decisions they've made, capital allocation, can they articulate the strategy? Is there any evidence in their behavior in the past or their background that leads us to believe that they can continue to execute in the future? And are their plans reasonable? And in our discussions with management, you know, we ask questions. We challenge whether, you know, what the opportunities, what the risks are, and you know, what variety of outcomes, we evaluate a variety of outcomes that can come out of that. But to your question, like, you know, what's changed over time, you know, we probably look more at like management incentives a lot differently today than we have in the past. We've had to do that. And, you know, so that's one factor. You know, we do vote our proxies here. So, you know, we think very carefully about corporate governance as well. You know, I don't think we're forefront on some of those factors, but, you know, it's a key factor in consideration in terms of how companies behave and how they manage themselves. And importantly, you know, we want to make sure that the incentives of management are properly aligned with shareholders. And I think that's been a greater focus of our team in recent years than prior. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, perfect. So, you know, just very quickly, you know, a sound fundamental business model, properly financed. But, you know, the key factor is also at the top of the page as well in terms of valuation. And so, you know, it's easy to find good companies out there, interesting businesses, industries that are growing. But the real opportunity only exists for an investor with that longer term time horizon when we see a dislocation from true intrinsic value. And we look at the net present value of future cash flows available to shareholders as the best metric to value virtually any financial instrument, but including a small mid equity. So we look very carefully at future cash flows and we project this out, discount that back to the future. You know, we have sanity checks in terms of looking at peers and history evaluation. And occasionally there are special situations where we can look at the sum of the parts of the business or a business that may not look like it does today in the future in terms of a future spinoff or a divestiture or an acquisition. and look at the sum of the parts of that business as well. The point is that it's a very disciplined approach to how we value companies. We think very carefully about it, and we think about the reasons why stocks can deviate from fair value. So there are behavioral issues where other investors may, due to temperament or a shorter term orientation, may react, greater or less to news items that we think are important or unimportant. There are analytical differences. Informational differences are few, but, we try to get to know our companies, much better than the vast majority of other investors. And sometimes there are technical factors that create dislocations from fair value as well. So perhaps a new corporate spinoff, where a large cap company has a subsidiary that can stand on its own as a publicly traded company. They spin it off to shareholders, the index funds sell, the large cap mandate managers sell. We're the guys on the other side of that transaction looking to see if there is a potential really good business here with an elite management team appropriately financed and maybe some technical factors that will give us an opportunity to invest in that company. And special situations, as I'll mention in just a minute, is one of the three focus areas. And in fact, we should go to that. Can we go back one slide, John, to the three categories here? Yeah. Okay. So I mentioned our longer-term orientation. That's one thing I really wanted to hammer home. The research focus of our team, that we have. The third thing is our real focus on what creates a market inefficiency and a mispricing in the market. What are those factors? I mentioned behavioral, analytical differences, informational, technical factors can create these opportunities. And we put a finer point by looking at by categorizing all these mispricings into three categories. So number one, so misunderstood franchise. So these are proven businesses in that small and mid-cap market cap range that, have strong returns on invested capital. They have reinvestment opportunities, strong management teams, appropriately financed. But even a small and mid-cap, high-quality business can from time to time fall out of favor with the market, or the progress of that business can be disruptive temporarily. And so it falls under that category of a misunderstood franchise. And we're the person looking at that with that longer-term orientation, thinking, okay, this is the opportunity we've been waiting for to keep a high quality aspect to the portfolio, the fundamental character of the portfolio, with a longer term horizon, and buy these misunderstood franchises at deep discounts to our assessment of true intrinsic value. Our strength here, our advantage, is that time horizon and that perspective that we have, where we're able to look over the very near term horizon that the market may be overreacting to, and having high confidence in the long-term true intrinsic value of that business and the ability of the market to close that gap over time. It's about 55-60% of the holdings in the portfolio. Underfollowed is fairly self-explanatory. I won't take that much time. It's about 10-15% of the portfolio. Three analysts or fewer on the sell side covering the company and publishing earnings estimates. So in short, we're looking where other fundamental investors are not looking, and that's our opportunity. So our experience, our focus, the depth of resources we have to provide research is our key advantage on underfollowed companies. And the third would be special situations. So changes in management, changes in strategy. I mentioned corporate spinoffs before. Business reorganizations and restructurings can be somewhat complex. Our ability and willingness to solve complex problems where maybe other investors will not, or perhaps there's technical factors, like I mentioned before, motivated sellers, like a stock falls out of an index or something like that, that can create opportunities in special situations. So three categories of underfollowed or mispriced companies: underfollowed, misunderstood franchise, and special situations is how we define those.
How do you think about the risk and return profile of the different categories? I noticed you said underfollowed is a smaller percentage. How do these things change? What are your risks? What are you thinking when you're allocating capital on the portfolio as a whole when you're looking at these areas of focus?
Perfect question. Thank you. A couple things on that. So I gave the weightings, you know, 55, 60, 10 to 15 underfollowed, so that special situations will be 20 to 30%. That's at any given time. And to that, to your point, to your question, we take what the market gives us. So this is the cool thing about these three categories. Number one is that we've chosen these categories because we have a 26-year history in pursuing these three. If you look at our slide deck from 26 years ago, you're going to see these three categories in there. And the reason why we stuck with them and we focused on it is that we have been able to add value at a risk-adjusted basis in all three categories over a long period of time. So it works, and we do measure the performance. But the weightings, and to the essence of your question, I think, is we take what the market gives us. And by looking at these three, and they're somewhat distinct and different from each other in any kind of market environments, expensive markets, cheap markets, growth markets, value markets, momentum markets, you name it, there's always something to work on in these three categories. So rarely are we in a position where, like, wow, we can't find enough ideas to fill out the portfolio. You know, in these three categories, there's always something to work on. But the weightings of the three, we don't target. And I think this is what you're getting at here a little bit. We absolutely just take what the market gives us. So in some markets, you know, that are expensive and a lot of resources are being applied to investment research in small and mid-cap companies, maybe those underfollowed opportunities are diminished a little bit. And then sometimes in bear markets and low markets, it's a, you know, it's a huge opportunity because, you know, where the sell side cuts back is not on, you know, large cap research, you know, the NVIDIAs and the Metas and the Googles, those analysts are, you know, there's going to be 60, 70 analysts publishing estimates on those, but it's in that small and mid cap area where resources kind of come and go. And special situations, you know, it's a function of what's going on in the economy sometimes in terms of how corporate managements and companies are looking to add value, and so restructuring, spinoffs, and things like that. It's been a pretty prolific area actually for many years. And you know, are we the only people that look at that? No, we're not. But we have a, you know, a tremendous long track record, and you know, a track record of adding value in all three of these categories.
Hey, Joe, so, similar to Eugene's question, though, and I think this might be particularly relevant, and I was going to do a time check here because I know we have 8 minutes and probably want to cover a few other things. But with the advent, the increase of the changes you've mentioned before between hedge funds, ETFs, large quantitative now strategies operating in this area, I mean, do you find that your informational edge goes one towards the other one? I think of a quantitative strategy, which I know these is being considered. I would assume that that by essence may or may not overlook some of these categories, which may or may not make more fertile hunting ground for your team that's focused on deep bottom up research. I mean, have you noticed a change as market approaches have changed?
It has evolved over time, but not necessarily as I expected. And, you know, we've been like, point number one, like these special situations, we've been looking at this for 20 plus years, 25 plus years. There's books written about it. You know, they're on magazine covers. And it's incredible how year in, year out, if you look at our top 10 performers for the trailing 12 months, it always seems to be four or five of them are special situations. And we're very, you know, particular in how we define those. And so to the point of your question, we're on the lookout for market changes that's going to diminish the opportunity. And we haven't seen it. And the second factor I'll mention to that, and this primarily applies to misunderstood franchises, is in my perspective, in some of the factors like ETFs and more hedge funds and you know, retail and a variety of factors, momentum strategies, that the market seems to be getting shorter term and shorter term. I think the advent of, I'm not a quantitative investor. We're very fundamentally driven. You know, we think very carefully about the companies we invest in and do we want to be aligned with them and the managements and the valuation opportunity. But, you know, there's quantitative funds out there, you know, algorithms that generate a lot of trading in the market, and it's super short term oriented, my understanding of it. And, you know, we're the fundamental guy on the other side of that trade. So I think that creates more opportunity for us. So I don't believe that individual stock selection is getting more efficient over time. You know, we can debate whether markets on a whole, you know, are more efficient or not. But I think many of the factors you just mentioned are opportunities for us instead of the opposite. And, you know, it's more and more like, you know, index funds make up 40% of the holdings of a lot of stocks in the market today. And the only thing they care about is the weighting of that company as they allocate capital into that index fund. Now, index funds have done pretty well against active. I'm going to acknowledge that in some categories. So, you know, let's just get that out up front. But they're not looking at the balance sheet or the earnings growth or the management team or capital allocation or things like that. So to me, it creates more opportunity and maintain that longer term perspective while the rest of the world gets shorter term and shorter term, I think is a superpower. And we just have to preserve it.
Yeah, thanks for addressing that. So we'll do a 5-minute time check, Joe. I don't know if we have maybe 3 minutes more on stuff that we should cover and then leave just a few minutes at the end in case there are questions.
So, you know, just to highlight it, and I'll just tell you the highlights of the rest of the slide. 65 to 90 holdings have been very consistent here. You know, we're kind of favoring about 70 right now, so we're at the low end of the range. You know, quality orientation for the portfolio, guardrails around the benchmark. So what you should expect from us is that this will be a stock selection driven, you know, performance. If we win or we lose, it's going to be because of our stock selection over the long term. And in any given quarter or a year, things like sector allocation, you know, will be a factor. But over a 3 to 5 year period, and I believe we have 3 to 5 year attribution in here. And, you know, you can see that the 3-5 year attribution is almost zero. You know, it's positive 0.07 for sector allocation for 3 years and negative 0.28 for allocation over 5 years. But stock selection, positive 129 over 3 years, 129 basis points above the benchmark. And for 5 years, 298 basis points over the benchmark. And so stock selection. And then the final thing I'll mention is on slide 24 is, you know, what does this look like at the end of the day? So quality businesses, growing business value over time, reinvestment opportunities, in absence of that, share repurchase, dividends, and we only buy these stocks when we find a dislocation from our assessment of true intrinsic value. So we have a discount multiple on our portfolio relative to the Russell 2500, but we have better growth rate and equal or better returns on equity of the companies that we invest in with better balance sheets as well. And in most environments, that's a good combination. You know, markets that are very concentrated in a few winners or a few sectors, that's tougher for us. And that's been more indicative of the recent environment, but over the longer term and the 3 to 5 year numbers that I'm focused on here that, you know, show us ahead of the benchmark, it's where quality prevails. And that longer term perspective as the rest of the world gets shorter term and shorter term focus and being able to accurately and conservatively value these companies and allowing for a margin of safety, given a variety of outcomes that can happen over the future. So those are the characteristics that have endured for 25 plus years in our portfolio. It's what we know best. It's endemic throughout the team. We have great depth on the team and a broad level of leadership. I just happen to sit in the chair I'm sitting in, but there's so many strong contributors on this team here. It's a privilege for me. And that's what you should expect going forward from us as well.
Okay. Thank you so much. Any quick questions? All right. Hearing none, we appreciate your time. Callan will be in touch. And have a terrific day.
Thank you all so much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Do we want to take 5 minutes?
Yes, please.
Just to update everybody before you dash off, we have one more. And then I believe we have a couple of administrative issues and a call to the audience. Thank you.
This is Patman. Can anyone hear me?
Yes, we're off break right now.
Oh, okay, good.
So, Eugene, I gather this this decision to set up this meeting this way happened at the meeting that I missed.
Correct.
Yes. I figured yes. That out. Yes. That'll teach you to have a coronary endoscopy on a Thursday.
Indeed. Indeed.
Oh, well. Well.
Oh, could you turn down the
yes, I can.
Just a little bit?
Oh, the AC?
Because it's cold.
I mean, I can try, but it's not.
Oh, well, that's okay.
Actually, is there even a thermostat in here?
I'm not sure.
Nope. Sorry, John.
Started. Are people back?
Yes, on our side.
Ernest Partners is dialed in as well. Myself and Chris Hovis.
I'm going to say, it doesn't look like
everyone. I'm sorry. Hold on. I'm not sure I have a board at this point. I've got two people, three.
If Sylvia and Angel are on, then you have. Oh, Sylvia just dropped on. Okay.
So you have a quorum. I need to drop off in 10 minutes. So is that going to cause a quorum issue?
Well, we've got Sylvia.
Only if Dave's not back.
We're gonna continue to have four members after Sylvia leaves, so we should be okay.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Dave is back. So we've got five right now at least. Okay. Let's get started. We have as our last presenter, Ernest Partners. Gentlemen, we are allotting 45 minutes. So if you plan to be done a few minutes after the hour, which would be about noon, Arizona time, I'm not sure where you are, but take about 45 minutes if you would, and take it away. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, first of all, thanks for having us. My name is Patman Malcolm. My parents thought it'd be a great idea to give me a first last name and a last first name. So you can call me Malcolm. I answer to that as well. I've also got Chris Hovis on the line. And between the two of us, we're both two of the partners at Ernest. We've been here for over two decades. And our plan today was to take you on a short tour of Earnest Partners, just in terms of who we are, what our resources are, talk about how we look at the mid-cap universe in terms of selecting securities, and then how do we get to that group of names that's very consistently outperformed the benchmark over time. So if you have questions along the way, don't hesitate to raise your hand or speak up. We can answer those. We're here for you. So if there's something that you want to talk about, just let us know. I think everyone has a presentation book in front of them. So I'll go ahead and get started. Real quick, though, Chris is one of the co-heads of the investment team, one of the lead PMs, and I'm responsible for product management at Earnest Partners. And so we're going to kind of break this thing up between the two of us, but don't hesitate to ask questions if you have them. All right, well, let's go ahead and get started. And I thought there's a little bit of background on myself and Chris at the front, but I figured I would go ahead and jump into who Earnest Partners is. Mark, you had referenced where we're located. We're actually in Atlanta. We don't get to talk to too many people where it's hotter where they are than where we are, but I think it's a little hotter in Tucson than it is in Atlanta today. Not sure you have the humidity we have, but nonetheless, that's what we consider central command and what we do. We've been around since 1999. We haven't tried to be all things to all people. We have figured out what we're proximate to in terms of our skill set, and we've tried to get better at that over time. And we've been able to grow the business, and we've been able to grow the firm, not from a huge marketing force, but by getting good results for our current clients and then having relationships with people like Callan, who understand how we invest, when we're going to do well, when we might not do as well, and have been able to grow the firm up over $40 billion over that period of time. A couple of things about Earnest that are a little bit unique and a little different. I would start with our form of ownership. We think that on this page is probably one of the things that's most important. And the reason for that is that the way that you control your culture in an organization is by making sure that you're only answering to one group of people. And we only answer to our clients as an employee-owned firm. We're not owned by an insurance company or maybe public shareholders or a private equity group, whatever the case may be. We're owned by active employees in the business. And one of the things that we've done over the last kind of 25, 26 years is we've made it so that if you're a partner in the business, you have to be active in the business. We don't want someone who has ownership that's sitting on a beach while other people do the work and enjoying the economic benefits. And that really changes the way that people look at what they do on a day in and day out basis, because everyone that comes in and works and gets things done, they have a real incentive to work harder and to work harder at getting along. And so for us, that's an important piece in terms of who we are and how we go about running the organization. The other thing I would say is when you look at the owners of the business and our net worth, over 50% of everyone's net worth is invested in the same things that we ask our clients to invest in. And we think that's, number one, the right thing to do, but it also creates an alignment in terms of the calibration of risk and return. And that aligns us with our clients so that over time, we're investing with the idea of generating consistent returns over time. Our client base is very diverse. In fact, if you go to the next page, you'll see that in terms of geographies and types of plans, it's spread out really around the globe. We share that because with all of our clients, we know that at the end of the day, they want the same thing, and that's the best risk-adjusted returns over time. And so we've been able to instill that trust and generate that return over time and been able to grow that over time. So obviously you'll get to spend some time with us today, and we'll put our best foot forward in terms of sharing what we do. But to the degree you recognize anybody on that list or that you would like to speak with one of our existing clients, we'd be happy to put you in touch with anybody that you might see on that page. Okay, let's go to the next page. And one of the things I wanted to talk to, and this is really kind of about the firm, is that when we started Earnest Partners, there was really kind of three different things that were crucial to how we ran the business. The first thing I would tell you is we wanted an investment team where every single person on the team had the ability to look at a stock from the perspective of a dual lens. And when we say dual lens, here's what we mean. You can look at a stock from the perspective of an analyst and a practitioner, right? So from the analyst standpoint, you've gone and gotten an MBA, you've got your charter, whatever the case may be. And then from the practitioner standpoint, you've actually worked in industry, not necessarily the investment management industry, but the industry in which you cover it. And that's the more difficult part. We'll talk about it as we build the team as if it's, you know, an easy thing to do. The reality is difficult, and we've worked at it over time to get it right. But every single person on the team, and I won't go through all the bios, but every single person on the team has spent anywhere from kind of 7 years on the low end to 20 years on the long end working in an industry where they had to go out in the world, run a business, compete, drive revenue, manage expenses, and ultimately deliver earnings. And that experience of having been out and run a business and been in the world gives a different perspective when you are looking at a business. The other thing that it does is that think about the conversations that we have with management teams. It would be one thing if we hired someone that went to a really good school and they were really smart and we said, hey, come on board, why don't you study technology for a couple years, and then once you've studied it, then start looking at names that might be interesting. The conversation that individual will have with someone that actually worked in the industry for 10 years are very different. In fact, I'll brag on Chris a little bit here. He doesn't like to brag on himself, but if you look at his background, you know, he has an undergraduate degree in physics and electrical engineering. And when he started his career, he went out to Silicon Valley and he was writing code. They didn't have Claude back then, for Intel, and was in the weeds of actually writing the code to say, hey, here's how I'm going to program this device to work. And then kind of moved up within the ranks to ultimately where he was running product management for products where he understood the coding, but he also understood what are the needs of clients. Because if you let a bunch of engineers design a product, it's going to be big and bulky. It might be fast, but no one's going to buy it because it's ugly and you can't carry it around with you or whatever the case may be. But when you bring those two things together, you have a much better appreciation for technology. So after spending a decade in Silicon Valley and being part of an investing club, decided to go back, get an MBA from Wharton, and has now been an Earnest Partners for a couple decades now. But my point is that experience of having worked in the technology space, I kind of skipped over the fact that he worked with a couple startups. One was very successful, the others weren't as successful. My point is he's seen all the different sides of technology. And so when he's covering technology names, that's very different than just having studied technology from the perspective of a textbook. And so everyone on the team has that type of background. If you looked at the person who covers logistics, they spent a decade moving people, equipment, food, and goods all over the world. If you look at the person covering healthcare, they have a PhD in microbiology, worked at the Center for Disease Control, actually here in Atlanta, worked for a biotech company, and so on and so forth. With the idea being that when we bring our team together, everyone has a very diverse industry experience where they look at how the world operates. They have a lot of different biases. Sometimes people say you don't want biases. We actually want all the biases in the room so we can embrace all the different biases. But we want that diversity of perspective and judgment and viewpoints in the room so that when we start debating a name, you cover all the different angles. And then once that debate is over, everyone puts down their pencil and we vote. And we'll talk a little bit more about how that happens. But that's the idea of how we've built the team is we want to bring people that have real points of difference in terms of their experience as practitioners and from an educational standpoint. And that was really the first point around the firm was hiring people that come from industry and have that dual lens perspective. The second thing I would tell you is that we felt there's a balance between good fundamental work where you're out talking to management teams and building a financial model and talking to competitors and doing channel checks, and then using data and statistics to get you in a better start point, right? And so we wanted to kind of combine those two. And so we developed a screen called Return Pattern Recognition, and I'll talk about that in a little bit, that gets us in a better starting place. And then once we're in that better starting place, we like to call it our fertile fishing pond, then we do the fundamental work. But that screen is called Return Pattern Recognition. And then we also developed a risk model internally called Downside Deviation. And what we wanted to do was kind of combine those statistical tools and data with good fundamental work to ultimately put together the best portfolio. We've been doing that for a long time.
Quick question, Patman.
Yeah.
Is it a prerequisite that the analysts are working on a stock? Is it a prerequisite that it is in that fertile fishing ground or had come out of the screen? Or yes. How do you address things not taken up by the screen?
Yeah, no, great question. And you honed in on something that occasionally can be a little contentious, right? Because let's say we bring someone on the team, they've been in this industry, and they get in, they're like, oh man, I know this company over here is a great company, we should look at them. But if it hasn't come through the screen, it is not a candidate for going into the portfolio. That doesn't mean that you can't study the name, understand what's driving it, and as soon as it does come through the screen, then you're on it. But here's the reason why. If you don't stick to the process, then you don't have a process, right? And what we don't know is if we all of a sudden start giving exceptions to, hey, you can bring this name in over here and you can bring this name in over here, we don't know what we're going to get. But what we do know is that when we follow the process of picking names that come through the screen and then doing the fundamental work, it's very consistent outperformance relative to the benchmark.
Thank you.
Now, there is a feedback loop, and Eugene, I'm going to finish the answer to your question when I talk about the screen, because one thing that is very important is sometimes we say, well, why isn't that name coming through? And we'll take that information and feed it back into the test that we do on the screen to say, hey, well, maybe if we change a couple things, the efficacy of the screen will get better. And so that way there's this feedback loop of what's actually happening in the world. A good point.
Thank you.
And then the third point I already hit was the fact that we wanted to be employee owned. We did not want to be one of these firms that was getting pulled in a bunch of different directions. And every time a new product comes to market that has higher margins than what we're doing, then we get forced to chase it, right? I mean, like right now, you know, everybody's chasing private credit. You know, 10 years ago it was a 130-30 strategy. And there's all these different strategies that come out and people want to chase them because they're the sexy product or they have higher margins. If you're an employee-owned firm, then you don't get those pressures, and you're able to stay focused on what you're good at and just focus on getting better over time. So sometimes people say it's boring, but we're one of the few employee-owned firms that's been employee-owned for 26 years doing the same management of the long-only portfolio. So with that, let's move on, and we'll jump to the process. We put the bios in here for you to peruse in your own reading. And when you read through it, you'll notice all the different industry backgrounds that people come from. But if we land on page 13, let's go back one page and I'll start here. And I know in the position that you're in, you've seen a lot of different funnels. Whoever's controlling that screen, if you want to go back one page, there we go. Perfect. Thank you. You've seen a lot of funnels that you're in the position that you're in. Now, we don't pretend to have invented the funnel, but for each one of the steps along the funnel, we go about things in a little bit of a different manner. So let me start at a high level and say, from an investment philosophy standpoint, here's what we believe. We believe if you're a manager and you want to deliver consistent returns over a benchmark, you've got to be able to do three things well. And those three things are, one, you have to be able to focus your attention on the right set of companies. Sounds easy, a little more difficult. Number two, you have to be able to manage the right kind of risk. And then number three, you have to have the resources in your organization to actually roll up your sleeves and do the work yourself. You can't just go out, read a bunch of sell side research reports, and then adopt the opinions that you think are most accurate. You might get it right for a quarter or a year, but when you start stretching it out over cycles, you just can't get it right. And so that philosophy is what really makes up our process. And so let me back up and go into a little more detail on the steps. So the first thing I said was, you got to be able to focus your attention on the right set of companies. And we developed a screen that we call return pattern recognition. And if you go to page 14, I'll kind of explain what all these circles mean. And when you think about our industry, there's not many things that are for sure. The only thing that we know for sure is that nobody has the resources to go out in the world and look at all the mid-cap stocks out there in the level of detail that you would expect, and then show up to you and say, okay, we looked at all these companies in the level of detail that you would expect. Here's the 50 or 60 best ideas. Because from a resource standpoint, it's just an impossible task. It's too many. And so the industry has come up with different ways of narrowing that down to a smaller list of names. And the way that we do it is we've developed a screen called return pattern recognition. And probably the best way to explain how we do it is compare and contrast to what typically happens in the industry. Here's what typically happens in the industry. Typically, a manager will go out in the world and they'll say, here's the Acme Capital stock that I want to own on behalf of my clients. And they'll come up with their checklist and they'll say, look, we want to own companies that have expanded margins. That's a good thing. We want to own companies that trade at no more than 20 times earnings. We don't want to own companies that have no more than 50% debt on the balance sheet, and so on and so forth. Then take that checklist, run it against the mid-cap universe where there's a match. Those are the names that you look at in more detail. The drawback to that approach is that it assumes one size fits all. It assumes that the characteristics that are important for a healthcare company are the same set of characteristics that are important or predictive of outperformance for a technology company or a mining company or a pharmaceutical company or whatever the case may be. And we know from our industry experience that what drives a company to outperform is going to vary depending on the industry in which it operates. And so we came up with return pattern recognition. And the basic premise there is that based on the industry that a company operates in, the financial and economic characteristics that are predictive of that company outperforming, it's going to vary depending on that industry. And so here's what we've done. We've taken the universe of stocks, the index, and we divided it into 36 industry clusters, okay? And we took every single name in the benchmark and we put it in one of the 36 industry clusters. And then we did that for every month going back to the inception of the benchmark. Now we have companies that are clustered together that respond to similar financial forces. Now keep in mind, this is a model, so it's not perfect, but generally speaking, they respond to similar financial forces. And there's a lot of work that goes into that, which we've obviously already done. But once we've done that, instead of saying, here's the characteristics that I want a company to have because I think that's good as a manager, we turn that argument upside down and we say, let's go back in time. Let's start with that first cluster and let's identify when a company within a cluster or when companies within a cluster do better than their peers. Let's observe what were the characteristics in place prior to them outperforming. And then let's capture that and say, okay, well, what were those characteristics? And then we do a lot of robustness testing, a lot of, out of sample testing over the course of the history of the benchmark to say, okay, we've run this, and if companies have these combination of fundamental characteristics in place, they've tended to do better than their peers. And we call that the return pattern. The reality is we're testing tons and tons of candidate patterns, but the one that has the highest information ratio is the most predictive. That's the one that becomes the return pattern. Once we have that, then we go to the next cluster. We do the same thing, so on and so forth. So when we're done, we've got these 36 patterns that say, hey, in this particular cluster, when you have this combination of fundamental characteristics in place, you've tended to do better than your peers. Then it's very easy to look at the world today and say, okay, let's start with the first cluster. What companies have that pattern in place? It might be five or six. We take those five or six, we put them in the middle of the table. So on and so forth through all the clusters. When we're done, we've got about 150 names that we believe are predisposed to outperform based on their financial and economic characteristics. That's the fertile fishing pond. And then, so at this point in time, no decision has been made in terms of if we're going to own it or not. But this is where the team rolls up its sleeves and say, okay, my background is technology, and there's some technology names in here that look really interesting. I'm going to start from the ground, build an investment thesis, build a research report, and really test to see if this name is priced appropriately by the marketplace. So that leads to the research, and I'll let Chris jump into how the research process works and maybe share a name.
Sure. Thanks, Patman. Any questions before I jump into the research process? If you could skip ahead to a couple slides, slide 15. I'll be referencing the boxes here, but I think most importantly, as Patman said, I'll talk about how it works in practice and then share an example of a stock that we hold in the portfolio and how it went through the process. But at a high level, for each company, we're going to have an individual on the team that's primarily responsible for the research, but most importantly, bring the collective experience and wisdom of the team together and ultimately make the decision about which stocks get in the portfolio. And while the specifics of the process can